all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and I'm glad you joined me today. Thanks for tuning in. And, of course, every week I look forward to talking with you for 3 hours on Sundays on a full range of topics that have to do with, ultimately, with ethics, values, and religion. The show, of course, is called Stand to Reason, and my goal is to give you a piece of my mind today as I think through and talk through some of these issues with you and with occasional guests. First hour, though, it's going to be with a guest, and then in the second hour, we'll open up the lines for you to... Oh, somebody hit the wrong button. Should I call a fast show? That's the closing music. How did that happen? I think we got a demon here in the studio. We got to cast him out. But this first hour, we're going to be talking with a guest, and not with you. So what I was saying, I think, before the interruption is hour number two, you can get in the queue. And we'll be willing then to talk with you about any of your comments, questions, or reflections on either the first hour's conversation or anything else that that comes to your mind that you want to talk about. The Darwinian evolution paradigm has been a controversial issue for a long time. Specifically, at least in that characterization, Darwinian evolution paradigm, in some sense, 150 years, because this is the 150-year anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species in 1859. And even though the conversation has been a lot about Darwinian evolution, not as much has been known about the author of the scientific movement that bears his name. Now, he's not entirely the author of all the ideas of that scientific movement. We'll talk about that in a moment. But this is what people associate as the founder of the evolutionary ideas, Charles Darwin. Who was he? What's his background? What drove him to do what he did? Since this is not just the 150th anniversary of his seminal work, The Origin of Species. It's also the 200th anniversary of his birth, and therefore a lot of time this year is being given to reflecting on the impact of Darwin. So I thought we'd spend some time and find out a little bit about the man behind the ideas. The book we're going to talk about is called The Darwin Myth, The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. The author is Benjamin Weicker. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and also a senior fellow of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. PhD in theological ethics from Vanderbilt University is his degree. And you know, he's done a number of books. I think we've actually had him on the show before, but I sometimes lose track of this. First, Dr. Weicker, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to say welcome back because I think we might have had you on another title about Darwinism and ethics or something like that.
Indeed, it was moral Darwinism.
There you go.
That was way back. That was in 2002.
Well, this is where I think in that book that I first learned about the role of Lucretius.
Yes.
Who's one of, you know, it goes back to the ancients who really advanced to some of the seminal ideas that found their way into other philosophies prior to Darwin and then Darwin himself. But that's a different story, although it does come up a little bit in this new book, The Darwin Myth. The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. It's kind of a provocative subtitle and title, in fact, The Darwin Myth. I think most people would expect someone from the Discovery Institute to write about the Darwin Myth, but then The Lies of Charles Darwin. That sounds to go beyond what most people talk about. So why don't we just get going on the life of Charles Darwin, and we'll see how the lies fit in there.
That's a good way to go. And this is written as a biography because he is a fascinating person. And, you know, people want to, you know, you find two tendencies. People want to put a halo around them or they want to put horns on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to give, okay, let's get Darwin warts and all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out that he was in many respects he was just a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good father, a good husband, you know, an honorable man in every way. Yet at the same time, there's interesting things about his background that play into the way that he defined evolutionary theory mm-hmm. that people don't get. Mm-hmm. They don't hear about that. You know, they hear about Darwin the hero. Who, you know, got on the ship, the HMS Beagle, saw evolution in action, came back, you know, brooded over that and told the world, and then the world immediately affirmed him, unless, of course, you know, you were a fool, in which case, you know, only fools would possibly contradict him. And that's just not the story at all.
Yeah, that's part of the myth, as you describe
that's
it in the book.
Myth. And exactly. And the life corrects that.
Well, I was particularly impressed, though some of these details I knew before. I was impressed how you laid these things out, that, and we'll talk about this in just a bit, but the that some of the most vocal critics against his characterization of how biological life developed on the planet were actually not only well-established scientists who had principled objections that, of a scientific nature and of an evidential nature, but were also some of his closest friends.
Yeah. I mean, you hear about all the enemies. Let's look at his friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you think, and it'll be interesting, by the way, there's a movie coming out, I think, in the fall, and it'll be interesting to see how they treat these people. But we're talking about world-class scientists, Charles Lyell, the great geologist.
Geologist, right.
Yeah, and Asa Gray, the American botanist. These were his friends, those who were promoting, you know, they had no problem with evolution, but they had a problem with Darwin's attempt to purposely exclude God. Another one on this list that is so important, so misunderstood, so often overlooked, is the co-discoverer of evolutionary theory, the man Alfred Russel Wallace, given by Darwin. You know, the title, you know, this man is the co-discoverer of you know, the theory of evolution through natural selection. Well, Wallace himself, in thinking about it more, said this doesn't do it. This doesn't explain evolution. It's not the theory is stunted because you're trying to exclude God, and it shows most clearly its scientific shortcomings in trying to explain the intellectual, moral, and even physical development of human beings. Darwin was furious. There's the co-discoverer of evolution publicly saying Darwinism isn't enough.
Yeah, that's an interesting story on its own, because Charles Darwin was very protective of what he considered to be his own theory, which you demonstrate is not really accurate in any sense of the word. I mean, he's kind of assembled things and added more to it and obviously popularized it beyond what anybody had done. But just before he was ready to, in a sense, go public, he gets this note from Wallace himself, this short article that Wallace wants him, I think, to pass on to Lyell and some of the other, you know, bigwigs, because he knows that Darwin has access to these guys. And here was Darwin's own ideas, or basically a parallel account of it, that he was asking, that Wallace was asking Darwin to advance on Wallace's behalf and make more public. So that was
it's amazing. I mean, that would make a good movie, because here, you know, And Wallace's treatment of it was beautifully concise. That's, I think, what pained Darwin. Here he'd been working on this thing for 20 years, you know, afraid to publish it because all the ramifications. He gets something from Wallace that just beautifully written, concise, to, you know, to the point, says it better than Darwin did in many more words. Now, here's where Darwin's honorableness came in. He could have pitched the letter, and no one would have known. Because Wallace was,
you mean pitched in the sense
of
thrown it, not pitched it to Lyell, right? He could have burned it.
Wrong word. He could have destroyed it, and no one would have been the wiser, and that would have allowed him to claim the theory as his own. So he was crestfallen, because as you point out, you know, he really did. He actually used these words. You know, think of this as his baby, literally his baby. You know, and when Wallace printed that publicly and said, you know, here are the problems with natural selection, boom, 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 boom. Darwin wrote on the page, no, 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 and he wrote to Wallace saying, you have murdered our child.
Right, right.
You have murdered our child. This is a strange way to look at it, right? I thought I was just pointing out the problems with it, you know?
Well, let's go back just a minute to some of the history here before Charles Darwin, because I had learned a long time ago, but I don't think most people know this, that the concept of what we think of as Darwinian evolution, the broad basics, I mean, even I think the term Darwinism goes back to his grandfather, Erasmus, who had a significant influence on his thinking.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and you brought up Lucretius a little earlier, who's the first century B.C. Epicurean philosopher who laid out basically an anti-theistic account of evolution. Well, it wasn't an accident that Lucretius was an enormous influence on the 1800s. and especially the 1700s, and one of the most influenced was Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who was one of the most renowned poets of the age.
Hmm.
And he wrote nature poetry and also wrote treatises mm-hmm. that incorporated, what was called transmutationism then.
Mm-hmm.
But this is before Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. I mean, it was actually, we think of Lamarck as putting it forward before Darwin, but it was actually Erasmus Darwin
mm-hmm.
playing off Lucretius and publishing in, I think it was 1794, this treatise Zoonomia, which had was published all over Europe and America. So when Darwin himself, this plays into the Darwin myth, you know, mm-hmm. what really happened, when Darwin himself went off to medical school, this is before he ever, you know, did anything scientific, he went off to medical school following in the path of his grandfather and father as a doctor, there he was immediately known as the son or the grandson mm-hmm. of the most famous transmutationist in Europe, mm-hmm. evolutionist in Europe, Erasmus Darwin. And so the radicals flocked to him. He was well known, but not on his own account.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic. He was the like you point out, the well-known guy, I'm thinking of like a rock star, you know, kind of thing, the celebrity. That's the word I was digging for. But in virtue of Erasmus Darwin's Darwinian evolutionary ideas, not his own, which hadn't really flowered yet.
Yeah, and his own father, Robert Darwin, was also an evolutionist, although he kept it underneath his coat, so to speak, because at that time, evolutionary theory was associated with the radicals,
mm-hmm.
The social radicals. It was a well-known aspect of the French Revolution. The Tory press, incidentally, published a picture of Erasmus Darwin as a monkey, holding a copy of Zoonomia. Now, this is uh-huh. before the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
This is over 50 years before Darwin published The Origin of Species.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's amazing. Now, and that gives us a reason why Darwin kept it underneath his hat for so long, because it was, you know, here's Darwin part of the, you know, wanting to be a part of the established scientific class, which was stuffed with Tory Anglican conservatives, mm-hmm. and he's got this radical past.
Okay, now there's something that comes that's starting to emerge here that I think is an important part I want to point out, and that is that there are these ideas that are in development with people in Charles Darwin's own family and that are being accepted by a radical element already in society, socially radical, but also in a sense spiritually or religiously radical because of the naturalistic, we'll say maybe the materialistic underpinnings there. And if I understand you right, this is a package that kind of went together at the time with the idea of Darwin of evolution, but was not something that was among the gentry, as it were, socially acceptable. So this is why some of these guys were Unitarians. They were kind of religious in a nominal way, so they didn't appear to be total barbarians in holding to this more materialistic or atheistic view of origins. Have I got that right?
You do, and that kind of masking occurs quite frequently. The radical, Darwin's teacher, his most important teacher at Edinburgh was Robert Grant. He wasn't actually teaching in the curriculum, but he was mm-hmm. teaching. He was tutoring Charles Darwin in evolutionism. He was a radical social revolutionary. He saw the two go together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Robert Darwin, the father of Charles Darwin, was an interesting guy. He was inwardly radical, but outwardly very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because he was a member of the rising mercantile class.
Mm-hmm.
He had radical ideas. He was certainly an atheist, but he doesn't want society upset because that keeps that would undermine commerce. It would bring the kind of destruction that occurred in the French Revolution, and when that happens, you can't make money.
Well, it reminds me of modern day politicians who
yeah.
all have to be quote-unquote Christian of some sort in order to get elected, even though they lead lives of practical atheism and maybe in their private musings, this is what their beliefs amount to. But there is this, broadly political advantage to aligning oneself, them, with a kind of religious movement, and the same was true then.
Oh, absolutely. And no one was more clear about that than Charles Darwin's father, Robert. That's why he sent him. When Charles flunked out of Edinburgh Medical School, which was a shameful thing to mm-hmm. do. You know, there you had two European-wide famous doctors in a row, mm-hmm. Erasmus and Robert.
Mm-hmm.
Flunks out of medical school. What do you do with your loser son?
Mm-hmm. You make a preacher out of him.
You make him a priest. You make him an Anglican priest. You put him in a country parish. There you go, Charles.
Mm-hmm.
You can go out there and ride your horse, and you'll still be respectable. You know, shoot, you know, collect bugs, whatever you want to do. And so you have this respectability. He's willing to support the Anglican Church. He sees Anglican Church supporting society and keeping things stable. But his own beliefs were simply, you know, he's an atheist. And so you'd never want to overread anything religious that Charles Darwin himself says.
Okay, well, I want to underscore this here, and we want to be careful, and we'll give more information later. We're not just dismissing this man's ideas because of his theological stance, but his grandfather is an atheist. His father is a closet atheist, essentially, just carrying on the guise of religion for political reasons in the community. This is these are his own convictions. We created problems with his wife,
mm-hmm.
He postures in his own autobiography, and I think this is a common perspective that people have, and I want you to speak to this when we get back from break, which is we're going to in just a moment. But he postures as a religious person who has deep convictions, standard convictions about religion like everybody else, and he has those convictions arrested from him by the force of logic and science. And this isn't quite exactly the way it was from what your book describes. So we're going to come back to that. My guest is Benjamin Weicker. He's the author of The Darwin Myth, The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. We're talking about Charles Darwin's life a little bit because it's the 200th anniversary of his birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. And we're going to see what actually the truth is behind that and find out more precisely what the Darwin myth itself is. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
Question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions, from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and Is One Way the Only Way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, friends. Talking with my guest today, the author of The Darwin Myth. His name's Dr. Benjamin Weicker. We've had him on before talking about things like this. He's a member of the Discovery Institute, a senior fellow there, in fact. and is taught at Marquette University, St. Mary's University, Thomas Aquinas College. Ben, you have written a book called 10 Books That Screwed Up the World and 5 Others That Didn't. I mean, that's just a fascinating title. I almost
want to
take a little discursus on that one, but we'll let this pass.
We can do that another time.
Yeah, we will do that. I imagine that one of those books would be the topic of discussion today. That is The Origin of Species.
Nope, The Descent of Man.
Oh, The Descent of Man. As you argue in this book, they're really two books, one idea.
Exactly.
The Descent of Man, which comes, I think, 10 years later, was really a continuation of his original ideas. But I think the subtitle of The Origin of Species is really telling, and this is what you probably know it by memory. I'm looking for it right now, but if you can provide, oh, here it is. The Origin of Species, The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's the subtitle of this famous book we're talking about and celebrating its 150th anniversary now.
Yes, and that's the interesting thing about that is when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, so it's being published in 1859, he kept out any notion, any word about human evolution, mm-hmm. and he also kept out anything about God. Okay, so he understood in order to get his theory, his version of the theory, because evolution was known before, it's his version of it, we got to keep mm-hmm. that clear. In order to get that to have a hearing, he couldn't say anything about human beings at all, mm-hmm. and he had to keep silent about God. Now later, he in order to help The Origin of Species get accepted, he put in what amounts to sops to people, you know, mm-hmm. talking about the creator. But we have him on record in a private letter, and I have that in Darwin Myth that he never meant to do that, and he never meant anything, you know,
theistic.
It was one more instance of posturing.
He's just throwing crumbs to the religious folk out there, so they don't get too alarmed. Is that the reason why he didn't do Descent of Man material in The Origin of Species? Because it was just too controversial.
Yeah, it was too controversial, and we know that he had thought all this through beforehand because we have his notebooks. From almost the very, instant that he steps off the HMS Beagle, mm-hmm. he is working madly on these notebooks, and the thing that he's most obsessed about is giving him a purely materialist account of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that purely materialist account is in his mind the whole time for the next 25 years. It comes out in The Descent of Man, where he applies natural selection to human beings. So races, the favored races,
in the subtitle there.
Yeah, in the title of The Origin of Species, always included human beings.
Right, but it's not just that. I mean, our first read of that would be probably human races, but he's really referring there to species or kinds, but include distinctions of human beings as well.
Yeah.
So it's included in that, but he doesn't focus in that in the first book. We're kind of dancing around another issue, though, that I want to get to, and it has to do with his metaphysical materialism that is deeply ingrained in part of what you call the Darwin myth. Let's go back, though, to that comment I made just at the end of the first segment, and that is that we have this picture of a country preacher that goes on this this little trip, 5-year trip or whatever, on the HMS Beagle to pursue his own curiosities with the natural realm, and then has his orthodox faith assaulted by what he discovers in the natural realm, and has his Christianity and his theism wrested from him almost against his will by the resistless force of logic and scientific fact. But as you describe in your book, this is far from the truth.
This is, and I think that this movie that's coming out, it's playing first at Toronto Film Festival, called Creation, plays on this. It's called Creation. Yeah, I'm actually looking at the web page now. The 10th of September, the Toronto Film Festival. I saw a trailer of it, and it plays on this notion. And it's myth. Okay, let's call it a myth.
Okay, when you say plays on it, do you mean it advances this myth?
Okay. So you have this picture of Charles Darwin, the believer, whose eyes are opened purely mm-hmm. by science. He wrestles, it's an awful thing, but then he gives in to reason mm-hmm. and he accepts that evolution is entirely godless. Mm-hmm. Well, this is just wrong. This is a myth. You know, Darwin came from a radical Enlightenment background. They had already rejected Scripture. It's not only for the radical Enlightenment, Scripture is not just wrong, it's pernicious, and so it needs to be done away with.
Mm-hmm.
And the Darwin family had a, you know, were part of this tradition that saw human history in terms of moving from darkness, ignorance, superstition, religion to enlightenment, mm-hmm. to a secular utopia. He's part of that. Well, when you do, when you believe that kind of myth of secular progress, that's the kind of story you tell about how you discovered evolution, right? Notice, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I was a believer too. You know, I know you're all believers out there, and I wrestled with it, but I had to accept reason. Well,
mm-hmm.
he was a secular thinker before mm-hmm. simultaneously with being evolutionary thinker, mm-hmm. and all that was long before he ever stepped foot in the HMS Beagle. And so this is one of the things that, you know, in some ways I hate to charge him with this, but it is a lie.
Well,
in his autobiography, he says when his father sent him to Cambridge to become, as an undergraduate, to train for the priesthood, he believed every word of the Bible was as literally true. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
That's nonsense. I mean, that would be so out of character of the Darwin family, you know, who on both sides, not only in his own side, but on the side that his wife, you know, the Wedgwood side,
mm-hmm.
That he married Emma Wedgwood. Well, you know, Josiah Wedgwood was a free thinker, so was his father, so was his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have this tradition of radical thought that rejected Scripture.
Not his wife, though, but... Not his wife, but the others on that side of the family.
Not his wife. Now, that's one of the irony of it, because here you have the respectable Josiah Wedgwood, just like Robert Darwin. You mm-hmm. want to hold up the public order, and the Anglican Church does that.
Mm-hmm.
So you send your girls to Anglican, you know, training to the religion you don't think they're taking seriously, and here is his daughter, Emma Wedgwood, is literally reconverted, sort of swimming
right.
backstream
mm-hmm.
into, and becomes a believer.
So in the case of Charles Darwin, then, we've got a guy that, you know, in a sense has a philosophical axe to grind. He has a point of view that he's not entirely honest about.
Exactly.
And what we don't want to say that just because he has this point of view that faults the science itself, but it turns out that the science, at least the way Darwin characterized his view, has been compromised and was challenged on those grounds by his contemporaries. But that compromise is, to some degree, as I understand your book, the very thing that is problematic. It is the myth, that the materialism that went along with it. So why don't we talk specifically about what the Darwinian myth is? What is Darwin's myth, the Darwin myth?
It fits into that larger, what I call the secular myth. Or in the book, The Liberal Whig Theory of History, where, again, you're moving from darkness and superstition to light. What gets you there? Pure reason.
Mm-hmm.
What is that represented by? The new materialist science mm-hmm. that chases away all those silly spirits. Okay, so you've got a fundamentally materialist bias, which we see in his notebooks right from the get-go.
And this is like thoroughly modern.
Thoroughly, yeah.
That
I mean,
is enlightenment modern, right.
He's trying to explain how it is that thoughts are you know, excrescences from the brain, like mm-hmm. a liquid,
mm-hmm.
and that the feeling, the religious feeling, can simply be duplicated by splashing cold water on you,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you know, you
I wish
you
it was
know.
That easy, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's I guess one of those great ironies. He went through these water treatments later, where they're splashing cold water on him. Never gave him religion, but
right.
That's another thing, but. But here you have this predisposition to give a very materialist, reductionist account of everything,
mm-hmm.
of human thought, of the origin of human religion, of human morality. It's already in place, and he uses that as the foundation to explain to what evolution is.
Mm-hmm.
And what's important is what you pointed out earlier, there are other people who saw the same evidence, even affirmed evolutionary theory, and rejected that purely materialist
mm-hmm.
foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And what was central to that is the exclusion of the notion that human beings have a soul or that there are spirits, therefore there are no angels or God.
Right, right.
Okay,
right.
So you, what are you trying to do? You're trying to make an account of evolution in which something other than God is the cause. And what he does is gives us random variation, that is, it's unintelligent,
mm-hmm.
there's no goal to it,
mm-hmm.
so it can't be a being, and death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's those are the two active forces, and neither of them are a God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's trying to explain everything on those, and it's scientifically defective because it's reductionist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it sounds to me like your main concern is somewhat twofold here. That one is that Darwin, because he has, you know, an atheistic bias, it's not just a bias. He has a program. He has an agenda. He wants to advance an accounting for the development of biological life on the earth that is able to do away with the existence of God. And as I understand it, you think that he fails to do that on scientific grounds. However, the scientific community by and large over the last 150 years since the publication of Origin of Species has adopted that model. Mm-hmm. And so the model itself is corrupted for philosophical reasons. But then your concern in the book, too, has to do with the issue of morality. And this is what reminds me a little bit of Moral Darwinism, your earlier book, that this then results if you kick God out of the picture. This has consequences that even Darwin himself was uncomfortable with on a personal basis.
Yeah, and really contradicted his own character.
Yeah, you said he actually lived better than his theory.
Absolutely.
He was a better man than his theory because his theory allowed for things that he would never countenance in his own personal life morally.
Yeah, but this is an important thing because, you know, I'm trying to say this in a delicate way, but it's common among those who are sort of on the left of things, that they put forth a theory which has awful moral consequences, mm-hmm. but they can't conceive that that would happen because they're personally generally good people.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have Charles Darwin, who's compassionate and kind, again, a model husband and father, puts forth a theory of morality in which those very virtues, the things he held dear, his own family, his own love of his wife, are the result of natural selection. That is, they're the result of survival of the fittest. What that means is it's the result of one people or race extinguishing another as the evolutionary ladder is pushed upward.
I think the way you put it in your book is the worst lie was the one that Darwin told himself, that he could have his moral cake and eat it too, as it were.
Yeah.
In other words, he could help himself to a philosophy or a scientific point of view that made him famous, which he was deeply committed to, but it also robbed him of any grounding of genuine morality, which he also valued.
Exactly. And one sterling instance is his deeply felt opposition to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the great abolitionists, the liberal Whig wing. Many of them were abolitionists. They wanted the slave trade stopped. Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was aligned with no lesser luminary than William Wilberforce.
Mm-hmm. By the way, just so our listeners know what you're speaking of, and you mentioned Whig, it's WHIG, which is a party.
Yeah.
It's a political party during that time.
It's the left at that time. Well, to say, you know, they're generally from the merchant class. They're against the Tory conservatives,
mm-hmm.
The aristocracy, and mm-hmm. the king.
But yet they were these that were Darwinists on the one hand were still strongly anti-slavery because it was obvious that slavery was a moral harm.
Yes, and he would never compromise that in any way, and he thought he wasn't in his theory, but. As William Wilberforce's son, Samuel Wilberforce, the famous Bishop Wilberforce,
right.
Yeah, pointed out to him, when you argue the way that you argue Charles Darwin, I mean, he knew him well because
mm-hmm.
the Wilberforces have been connected to them,
mm-hmm.
You will make slavery natural. It'll be as natural as it is for a certain kind of red ant to enslave a black ant.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's natural for them, if it has contributed to their survival, you can't say anything morally against these enslavement of one ant by another. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you can't say it against one human race enslaving another.
As Charles Darwin pointed out aggressively from the scientific fact of the matter was, as far as he was concerned, is there was an unbroken continuity between the animals and human beings.
That his whole argument in The Descent of Man is based on that, and I push that in the Darwin myth,
mm-hmm.
So that people understand that this is, as you pointed out, one long argument. You know, people should never just read The Origin of Species. The Origin of Species and The Descent of Man should be bound together. And when you do that, you see that Darwin had to affirm the extinction of one race by another, the enslavement of one race by another, although he couldn't bring himself to say it in that book. Oddly enough, he talked about the extinction of one race, one tribe by another, because that's the engine of evolution, and that was the cost of removing God, trying to explain the development of morality and human intelligence through natural selection alone.
Right. Well, to be more precise, in the case of Darwin, it wasn't just the extinction of the races, but it was the extermination of the races that
Indeed.
Was in view. So it and this brings us right to the issue of social Darwinism and Nazism and eugenics and everything else that kind of flowed out of that in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that seemed to be a completely legitimate applications of what Darwin understood to be the scientific fact, though such applications would be odious to him personally because his own deep sense of morality rebelled against these notions, but they followed completely from his ideas. And then when the people emerged whose deep sense of morality did not rebel against these notions, they get played out with horrifying consistency.
Yes, it is, and it was the Darwin family that helped do that. Remember, it's Leonard Darwin, one of Charles Darwin's son, who was the president of the first International Congress on Eugenics. Okay, so eugenics isn't something that we need to look for some kind of an origin from somewhere else. The Darwin's Descent of Man is the modern eugenic Bible. It's the thing that starts the movement.
Right, and the Nietzsche and Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, a whole bunch of American intellectuals in the early 20th century has picked up on these notions long before the Third Reich did.
Absolutely.
Before we go to break, one clarification. I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I have quoted this encounter between T.H. Huxley and Bishop Wilberforce, in which Wilberforce allegedly asks Huxley if he was descended from an ape on his grandmother's side or grandfather's side, and Huxley then roundly puts him down in a sense in appropriate fashion. But as I read your book, it sounds like that's a kind of an urban myth. It's
I'm
apocryphal.
Afraid, yes.
I'm going to have to take it out of my notes.
Take it out of your notes. I don't think that it's ever been verified. And what's even more important is what's been left out, that Wilberforce didn't give an impassioned defense of Scripture. What he did was he gave an impassioned defense of science, and he gave the latest scientific problems with Darwin's own theory, some of which, I remind listeners, were pointed out by the co-discoverer of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace. So that's what makes them sting. This isn't some kind of a merely scripture versus science battle at all.
Which is the way people want to cast it now, and probably that's what we're going to see in this movie, Creation.
Exactly.
Is that the title of it? Yeah.
Yeah, you are.
Well, it strikes me that this movie coming out is going to have the same kind of problem that Inherit the Wind had. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's just glamorization of an historical event, but done so in such a way as to totally twist it to serve some kind of political, philosophical end. So,
yes, and I'd like to say something about Inherit the Wind. If we have time now, are you going to a break?
Why don't you go ahead and say it quickly, and then we'll move on to other things just after the break.
Okay, well, here it is, folks. When you read the actual book by a man named George Hunter, which was at stake in the actual court case, what do you find there but lovely eugenics? It's one of the most, astounding eugenics diatribes occur in that book. Well, they never read those passages. Do they when you see Inherit the Wind movie? If they would read the eugenics passages about the people that would be better off if they were exterminated, then the movie would have played a little differently with Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, I suspect so. And caveat emptor, emptor.
Yeah.
Let the buyer beware with this movie coming up. My guest right now, Benjamin Weicker, PhD, senior fellow at Discovery Institute, author of The Darwin Myth, The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. We'll be talking about this in more detail when I return at Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. You want to find your mind if you've lost it. Right here on Sundays from 3 until 5. Hey, make that 2 until 5. See, we added that hour in the spring. I'm still not used to that. My guest, Dr. Benjamin Weicker. The book is called The Darwin Myth, The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. There are two things that stood out for me as I'm reading the book that seemed to be a big concern to you, Ben, in kind of talking about the life of Charles Darwin. And the first one is that Darwin is advancing a scientific theory that he is using to give an explanation for how everything could be accounted for without reference to God. So he has got an atheistic, maybe if you could say it, agenda or program that he's pushing forward. And you think that this is an illicit enterprise because you can have the one without the other. Have I got that right, at least in part?
Yeah, and this is not some kind of thing that I'm pulling out of my hat, and this is why I think we need to retell history, revisit history, and find out what actually happened. Because the usual story you get is, oh, people like Charles Lyell, you know, Charles Darwin's best friend.
Right, the founder of modern geology.
Founder of modern geology, and Alfred Russel Wallace and Asa Gray, they couldn't go the full Darwin. You know, they sort of pulled up short and they had a crisis and sort of cowardice took over them.
Because they're sympathetic to some of his ideas in terms of his observation about how the biological realm seems to be working in light of some of the fossil evidence, etc., but they can't buy the whole metaphysical package.
Absolutely not. So they have no problem with evolution, and they have no problem with the fossil evidence and anything, and they were affirming these things scientifically, but they disagreed with Darwin vehemently about the whether natural selection itself could really explain things. And we always got to keep in mind it was designed by Darwin to eliminate God, you know, because he seems to be adamant. Really, he didn't seem to be adamant. He's adamant. Don't add anything to the theory. That's why he's so mad at Charles Lyell, his own friend, at Asa Gray,
and
especially a Wallace.
Yeah,
because they wouldn't go the full Darwin. They wouldn't bite into the whole atheist worldview, and it wasn't of any scientific lack on their part. That's the myth we're told. You know, that there was a lack of courage, or they didn't see the science. Or, not true. They actually saw the defects of it. One of Darwin's greatest critics, the greatest critic of Darwin, it is. And the one he took the most time to answer in his Origin of Species was an evolutionist. St. George Mivart, who didn't have any problem with evolution and in fact saw evolution as something so wonderful that it proved the existence of God, but he shot holes through the entire origin of species. Now, we don't hear that in our in the stories that we're told about what really went on. We need to recover that, because there you have some of the best scientists of the day. None of them have a problem with evolution. All of them have a problem with Darwinism.
Well, part of what struck me as I read your piece and other accounts like it is many of the objections that were raised by these other scientists that were his contemporaries and were well-schooled, obviously, and totally capable in their discipline, and also liked him, Charles Darwin. They were personal friends. But the kinds of objections that were raised then are still the kinds of objections that are raised now, because in 150 years, these objections have not been adequately answered.
Yeah, and there's a reason, you know, and this is the one of the confusions that exists that I hope the Darwin myth can clear up. The reason that they never go away is that he tried to do everything through natural selection. You know, and that's
you mean a purely materialistic process.
Yeah, when you know, it's like Freud trying to explain everything in the Oedipal complex. You know, or it's like Karl Marx trying to explain all of human complexity as merely the reflex of our economics, life.
Right.
No,
so,
it's just too much.
Right. And there is the next piece to this, though, that I think you're careful to develop is that there is a price to pay for this metaphysical program of his, and the price to pay is morality.
Yes.
And this is where, explain what social Darwinism is and why it isn't just a defective characterization of Darwin's view, and that's the way it's approached by enlightened Darwinists of the day, but it actually is Darwinism. It is precisely what Darwinism dictates.
Yes, yes. And the reason that people want to distance themselves from so-called social Darwinism is it had all kinds of awful ramifications, only one of which was Hitler. We want to, you know, we don't want to reduce all the evil in the world to Hitler, because there's a whole lot of other things.
Yeah, give a brief definition of social Darwinism for us.
Well, really all it is the application of Darwin's Origin of Species to human nature, where you simply say that human traits randomly vary, and those who have the traits that are the most fit for the environment will survive, and a part of that process will be the picking off of the weak, the sickly, the malformed. Not only themselves, in other words, you should, as in the animal kingdom, they just let them die so they can get them out of the herd, so to speak. But it also includes the active extinguishing in battle of one tribe by another, one race by another. And so the application to the social scene is myriad. You know, don't help the poor, don't help the weak and the sickly. If you build hospitals, they just breed more. If you do nice things for people with lower intelligence, they'll breed more, will be overrun with, and I guess I'll use Margaret Sanger's word, the feeble-minded among us. So it's a notion that human beings need to, in their social life, affirm what nature does. In regard to evolution.
And because there is no God in the picture, this might makes right approach becomes, I don't even want to say morally acceptable, because strictly speaking, morality doesn't enter into it. Morality just, I mean, it's a fiction, because what is right, in a sense, by definition.
Well, it's what you know afterwards. When you see a trait that has emerged, whatever it is, what you can say about it is, well, it must have been more fit, but you can't say, oh, that was morally wrong plumage,
or
that's just the wrong, you know, that's an evil foot or something.
Well, we shouldn't be surprised then when Karl Marx gives Charles Darwin a complimentary copy of, Das Kapital, or the Communist Manifesto, because we see that that philosophy is at the heart of what turned out to be the bloodiest century in the history of man, the 20th century, where more than 100 million people died at the hands of communist dictators, you know, because this is, and this is the point of your book, this is the logical conclusion of social application of this scientific principle, at least as characterized by Darwin.
Yes, and that's important that you add that last part. Social Darwinism is not the hijacked form of what was a mere biology. I can't tell you how many times I've seen, Darwin just dealt with biology. He didn't talk about, you know, human beings and society and politics.
He did all the time, though.
Yeah, this is nonsense. It's because people haven't read The Descent of Man, mm-hmm. which I think should be on everyone's required reading list. Mm-hmm. Social Darwinism begins with Charles Darwin. It begins with his Descent of Man. It's the Bible of social Darwinism. There's no way to get out of it. And mm-hmm. I quote, extensively in the Darwin myth, so people right. can't say, oh, gosh, well, no, he never said that.
Yeah, well, you have a whole chapter on Darwin and Hitler, and you're really making the connection, not just ideologically, but historically, between Darwinism, properly understood at that time, and the actions of people like Hitler and the like. There's another point, and this I mean, this is, to me, is the most important point of the book. For my money, I wrote a book on relativism, you know, and the problem of trying to get around relativism with you know, gussying up evolution as if it can really give you a robust morality. Well, this is nonsense, as you pointed out in the book. So that's what resonates the most with me. No form of materialism can ground any genuine form of morality. There just is no morality, and to talk as if there is just that's the thing that's fairy tales. So I deeply appreciate that. But we just have a few minutes left here, though, and I want to ask you a couple of questions, because your last chapter has to do with Christianity and evolution. And at this point, I'm actually genuinely confused about something, and maybe you can help me. We are using these terms Darwinism and evolution. We've been using them throughout, and basically your implication, and clearly in the last chapter, is Darwinism is false. That would be kind of evolution with a materialistic foundation, no
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
But evolution is fact. And at this point, I'm confused about what you mean by evolution. And let me just toss this out, and then you can clarify for me. Because strictly speaking, as I understand it, Ben, nobody's really a Darwinist anymore, because they've rejected Lamarck in favor of genetic mutations. So we have the neo-Darwinian synthesis that stands in for Darwinism now, but this is also materialistic, so it has that kind of nasty aspect to it. Some people consider evolution to be entail also descent with modification. But even, you know, biblical literalists believe in that after a fashion, because Adam and Eve, everybody's descended with modification from Adam and Eve, and we have some variation within a kind there. So there's an ambiguity. There's a possibility there. Some think of Darwinism or evolution as the blind watchmaker thesis, which it sounds to me like you're rejecting.
Mm-hmm.
So you say Darwinism is false. I take that to be the blind watchmaker thesis attached to descent with modification in the way that natural selection, the mechanism that Darwin identified, but you hold evolution in some sense to be true, and I'm not sure if you're affirming a limited descent with modification or a maximal descent with modification with some kind of God involvement in the process or what. So if you could just take a moment and clarify what you mean by the evolution that you think is true, so that we at least understand where you're coming from in that.
Okay. And I'll try to be as clear as possible in the shortest amount of time. If you look at the kind of evidence that that was taken by all during the period of Darwin, that is by his opponents and some of his allies, what they're looking at here is the general evidence in the fossil record that mm-hmm. we've got species that are no longer around.
Right.
They look something like species that are. We can sort of line up most of them. There are gaps, but you see a kind of continuity.
So you could construct a scenario of descent with modification from the fossil record.
Yeah.
Is that what you're suggesting? Okay.
But what you wouldn't know are the causes. In other words, one of the problems with Darwinism is always assumes that it already has the cause in the bag. It's natural mm-hmm. selection.
Right, right.
Or some variation on mm-hmm. On that, some little riff on it, but not much of one. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, it excludes God.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the teacher of Charles Darwin, when he went off to Cambridge, was another founder of modern geology, Adam Sedgwick, who's
right.
the man who actually defined the Cambrian period mm-hmm. and hence most illuminated or began to illuminate the Cambrian explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There you had somebody who looked at the same evidence, all the same fossil evidence and that kind of progression, and saw creation as something culminating in human beings
mm-hmm.
as the Earth developed in conditions that would allow for these succession of species. He was a theist, right? In other words, he saw this as as for him, a way that creation was written toward the climax. Mm-hmm. So you could say it this way, creation was anthropic over time. It mm-hmm. really was defined by human beings after all.
As the end in mind.
As the culmination. Mm-hmm. And broadly speaking, that's how Darwin, those that affirmed evolution but denied Darwinism, all the evidence.
So would you say that, and I just got about a minute to go here, would you say that you hold to dissent with modification, but with the idea that there has to be intrusion of God to provide the kind of new information into the genome, you know, that's one way of putting it, in order for those modifications to advance? And so the creative acts would be the acts of creating information in some sense at some points in time?
I guess I would hold back from that, because here's where I become a strange kind of skeptic, but I think it's right to do this. I think we have been laboring for so long under the Darwinian paradigm, so long under reductionism, that the kind of evidence we have so far is so heavily weighted towards materialism that even those who are trying to use it well get tripped up.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to say, you know, I think that the science is so distorted mm-hmm. that we need to think again from scratch.
Fair enough. And the way you put it in your book, I think, is, and you use the word evolution here, but it's that evolution is so much larger and grander than Darwin ever thought it was, because God's involved in the process in magnificent ways that we still don't understand.
Yes. And I would take – here is my bet that if we truly understand it, it would act just like the proofs of God's existence that come from the fine-tuning mm-hmm. at the origin of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a slam dunk. So in other words, I'm arguing that if we do it right, and it might take about 50 years, mm-hmm. we're going to have, from something like evolution, a slam dunk argument for the existence of God, a kind of natural theology.
Well, Ben, as with our first conversation years ago at Moral Darwinism, How We Became Hedonists, this discussion with Darwin, the Darwin myth, has been fascinating, and the time has gone way too fast, obviously. There's so many fun things in here, and it was very helpful to me as I read through your book to get the background information on Darwin's life and to see that, you know, he had an agenda, and the agenda wasn't consistent with the facts, and if you follow consistently with his point of view, it leads to the kind of thing we saw in the Third Reich and the Gulag and a lot of other gruesome things that may still be ahead of us. So ideas have consequences, don't they?
They do.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Benjamin Weicker, the book, The Darwin Myth, The Life and Lies of Charles Darwin. Okay, lines are open, ladies and gentlemen, and 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you want to dial local 754-4150 in the 714 area code, you're welcome to do that, and I'm looking forward to talking with you. I'm Stan DeReese. Cow is le mou. The British cow goes moo, I think. Moo. The Italian cow goes mwah, mwah. All right. After today, I want that one to go in the trash bin. I don't ever want to hear that. Oh, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Yeah, that was me in a less circumspect moment, caught on microphone. Actually, that was probably about 12 years ago. I didn't have anything better to talk about on the air. Now I do. Show us Stand to Reason. We're an hour number two here. That means it's time for your calls. 1-800-227-5278. If you're local to me in the 714 area code here in Orange County, just dial direct at 754-4150. And have a special treat now. One of my old buddies a current buddy, but old colleague. No, still a colleague, but old employee, I guess is the best way to put it. Scott Klusendorf just showed up, and good to have you on board, Scott.
Greg, good to be in. I hope you don't mind me just dropping in.
No, it's great to see you. And you know, you're a shadow of your former self. What, you know, you've I mean, not that you're overweight before, but you look like an athlete right now. Are you training for a marathon or something?
No, it's called having teenage sons who will put me down if I don't stay in shape. This is necessity.
Well, the last I saw your boys, they were like, I don't know, like 7, 8, 9-ish, something like that.
We're talking 19, 17, and 12. And I'll tell you what, the 17-year-old is a beast. He's playing football this year, again, on both sides of the ball.
Oh, really?
And, you know, when he starts coming home and benching 260, I start to take notice and think, you know, wait a minute, he's 17, I'm 49. This is not going to work.
It's a good thing he's on your side, though.
Yeah, that's very good thing he's on my side.
That's great. So I thought it'd be a good opportunity just to spend a few minutes and talk about what's been happening with you. Of course, it's been about 4 years now since you left with Stand to Reason with our grace and encouragement to start Life Training Institute, LTI, and your move to Atlanta, which actually happened a few months before that. And when I get your mail, because I still support LTI, and I'm just thrilled at what you're doing. You're the most effective pro-life worker in the country as far as I'm concerned, and so that's my vote of confidence for anybody listening to consider helping out Scott's effort. I look at your schedule, and your schedule is always just chock full with events and schools and debates and training and stuff. So it sounds like you're as busy as ever at LTI.
Very busy indeed, and now with the book coming out, even more so.
That's right. Last time we talked was The Case for Life.
That's correct.
And it just occurred to me a couple of weeks ago that it was like The Case for Christ, you know, the similar kind of name, which was clever. So that's how it's easy for me to remember.
Oh, I stole the title wholesale. You know.
It's an excellent, it's a superb book, as we talked about then. So how are you getting a lot of activity because of that?
I think so, and I got a sense that the publisher was happy. I was at the International Christian Retail Show in Denver last week, and the president of publishing, or the head guy for publishing for Crossway, asked to see me. And I'm thinking, oh boy, what do I do now? He found something on page 79 he didn't like. And his first comment to me was, when you're writing your next book. So I took that as a good sign
Of course.
They're happy. And he did say sales were good. So.
And there's a couple of good books out. You know, Frank Beckwith has his piece out that was this rewrite of Politically Correct Death. And
correct.
I don't know what is The Case for
Defending
Life.
Defending Life is his current
book. Oh, Defending Life. There you go. And now I've got my little, you know, quick read, 5,000-word, whatever it is, 10,000-word Precious Unborn Human Persons. But the thing that I liked about your book, and I think I mentioned it at the time, is that not only is it a thoroughgoing popular defense, I mean popular in the sense of being accessible, I don't mean shallow because it's not shallow at all, but it's a accessible defense for life, but you actually venture into other areas that have to do with it, you know, philosophical areas, theological areas. And so it's a robust book that in the Standard Reason tradition is not just telling you what to think, but how to think as well.
That was exactly what I set out to do, Greg, and I learned well at STR. but see, the abortion debate has changed, as you know. There is now this pressure on the pro-lifer to defend every one of his starting points. So in the past, if you could show that the unborn were human, that should have been enough to compel people to look at our view seriously. Of course, now we have people who will grant that the unborn are human, but they don't think being human is very special at all.
Right. Yeah.
Now we're into metaphysics at a much deeper level. And I tried to write a book that was a bridge book between a Robert George, a Frank Beckwith, and others who are writing tremendously helpful books. And by the way, I do consider Frank's book the best full-length treatment of the subject you can get. It is second to none in that regard. The problem is how many lay people are going to pick that up. That was my concern.
Yeah, and he's written it too. I mean, I think Frank is alert to the popular concerns, but
yes.
He's really written it to just to speak to or answer in a definitive way the most sophisticated challenges. So it operates in both levels.
Yeah, exactly right. And, I mean, Princeton University publishing this is a great thing for our side.
Right.
That's a major academic publisher, and Frank just does a marvelous job taking you through this. So I can't say enough good things about that book. But again, I wanted to write a book that would be a bridge, so to speak, between a Frank Beckwith and maybe a Randy Alcorn, who's written a very user-friendly book on answering pro-choice objections. But your more learned person might want something a little more in the middle, and your lay person who doesn't have time to read a philosophical treatment of the issue is also going to need something a little more accessible. So that's what I aim for.
I was thinking, you know, you're talking about things have changed in the debate, and that now it's not enough to just enough to prove that the unborn is a human being. Now there are people who are willing to say, well, even so, abortion is still justifiable. It seems to me that maybe it's a human, not a person, and so you have that discussion. But then you also have, you know, I'm thinking of the Baby Born Alive Act, you know, where there's a legislation that's passed that says basically if you try to kill a baby and the baby is born alive, then you've got to treat that baby as the valuable human person that it is, because there shouldn't be any debate as to whether the baby born alive is a bona fide member of the human community. Yet, in fact, you know, you have people that are at the highest levels. I got in trouble talking about this a couple months ago, so I'm not going to go into too much particular detail about it. But, you know,
a
at
certain
the highest
unnamed
level that
politician,
are, yes, yeah,
yes.
But so this, yeah. This even that itself, the fact that the baby is born, is not a clear case example of a human person that should be protected. And so that, yeah. I mean, what Francis Schaeffer said, what was unthinkable yesterday is thinkable today and ordinary and commonplace tomorrow.
It is. And that is what we're seeing more and more of when I do debates and when I entertain questions, is people willing to call into question some of the most basic fundamental things that are self-evident for any rational person, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. I think it's an unjustifiable skepticism, mm-hmm. but it's one we need to be aware of. So I don't apologize for my starting point of human value. Thomas Jefferson had the same starting point, by
yeah.
the way.
That's right.
And I don't think he was some lightweight, religious, yeah. fundamentalist, light-minded thinker. This was a guy who knew the details. So,
well, they also understood the impact of ideas, mm-hmm. because when they started the American experiment, they didn't just postulate out of thin air rights that would ground the enterprise. They grounded the rights in the nature of human beings made in the image of God.
That's right.
And this is and that's the whole foundation. If you pull that foundation out, everything else is a house of cards.
Well, you look at our political history, Lincoln's second inaugural address, Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, and a host of other documents that we teach in history, hopefully, these things assume or state explicitly the dignity of man grounded in God. Mm-hmm. And so to say we can't have any of that undergirding our basic arguments doesn't fit well with the American experiment in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have in front of me something that Sam Casey gave me. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago, and I ran into Sam, who is the
good guy.
He's, of course, been at the – this has been dear to his heart for – ever since I've known him from his old days at Simon Greenleaf University. He's the president of the Christian Legal Society. Uh-huh. Yeah, I sometimes get the terms mixed up here, but thank you for that help. But he handed me this information. It says here May 15th, so this is a couple of months ago. More Americans pro-life than pro-choice for the first time. The numbers show that those who identify themselves as pro-life has just 2 months ago, and for the first time since these records are being kept since the mid-90s, have advanced into the majority, with 51% saying they're pro-life and 42% now saying they're pro-choice. What do you make of those statistics? Are those encouraging? You don't have an excited look on your face right now, so...
I'm skeptical, and maybe I'm unjustly skeptical, but I'll tell you why I'm not jumping up and down right now. First of all, if you look at polling data over the last 30 years or so, you will see a remarkable consistency. There's not been that much movement, with one exception, late-term abortion, mm-hmm. driven largely by the debate over partial birth mm-hmm. abortion, where the imagery and the descriptions of the procedure caused a giant yuck factor mm-hmm. Revolt in the public against late-term abortion.
Not the kind of factor that you would have, or I should say that you don't have that kind of factor in something like embryonic stem cell research.
You don't have it. And the thing to watch for is, what is the public saying about its support for first trimester abortion? And there, I'm not seeing great polling mm-hmm. data shifts. Also, I think you've got to look at the political landscape. People don't want to do that who are pro-life. They say, oh, this last election, they didn't really vote for Obama. Really? We're going to say that the public is by and large conservative, by and large with us on this issue, but somehow by some raw mistake, they voted mm-hmm. for the guy whose views on abortion are overwhelmingly known.
Mm-hmm.
There was no secret about what he held as his mm-hmm. views. So without getting partisan at all, just mm-hmm. stating the facts of the matter, I don't think the public was fooled at all. I think they viewed abortion as an issue that was way down on the totem pole versus other issues like pocketbook issues, health care they may have wanted, and other things. So I'm not ready to say that the public has jumped to our side.
But what about the Roman Catholic vote? Because this is a religious community that you have a lot of contact with in your work.
Right. What I'm finding there, Greg, is you have three essential groups of Catholics. You have Catholics who are very pro-life and they're very troubled by how the church structure is going. Then you have Catholics who are pro-life, but they're what I call the peace and justice Catholics. They view abortion as wrong, but they assume a moral equivalency when they look at abortion and other issues. So they'll say, well, abortion's wrong, but the war in Iraq is wrong. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I'll vote for the candidates who are the best on these other issues, and I can use mathematics then to say I've got the best pro-life candidate.
And actually, I think I read your rebuttal to that. Did you write a rebuttal to that idea?
I did.
And that had to do with the real pro-life, you would be against the war, and you just did the numbers, and it was really excellent. You mentioned the two groups there.
Right.
You have the strong Catholics who
right.
are doctrinally faithful
right.
and therefore faithful on this issue and will vote that way.
Right.
Then you have this group that says, yeah, I agree with that, but then you know, there are other pro-life issues
right.
that sway me, and then those mm-hmm. I would suspect largely stepped away from the classical pro-life candidate this last time around.
They did. And then the final group is the left-leaning Catholics who are outspoken in their advocacy for mm-hmm. abortion rights, for embryonic stem cell research.
Do they consider themselves Catholics?
I've asked them that. Tell me why. Because Catholic has to mean something. If you say you're Christian, you say you're Catholic, or you say you're Protestant, the label has to mean something in order to even function as a conversation
right,
piece.
Right, right.
And what I'm struck by is how Catholicism for them means whatever they like it to be, by and large, mm-hmm. what they're in love with is the feeling of going to the church, the rituals, the smell of the incense, the being part of a, quote, Catholic community, but they don't really define what that community stands
for. You know,
it
sounds to me much like in my last hour's conversation with Ben Weicker about mm-hmm. The Darwin myth. I don't know if you caught any of that coming in. But how back in the mid-19th century, which is when Darwin and his father and his grandfather were operating, they were deeply convinced atheists, but in the case of Darwin and especially his father, I don't think his grandfather Erasmus, but they just had to have this kind of participation in a religiously respectable organization
yeah.
because it was part of the community and there was political advantages to that. And I could think sometime even now people, though I think that Robert Darwin, Charles's father, was living in his own mind two different lives. I think that there are a lot of Catholics who are thinking they're kind of giving a certain lip service that they genuinely support,
mm-hmm.
but it isn't like it's going to influence their life very much. They're just, well, we have this religious area. It's kind of the ice cream insulin kind of comparison. This is the religious area of our life. We get something out of this religious community, and we can talk religious language, and we kind of feel religious a little bit. But when it comes to making the decisions of our life about the facts of the matter, when it comes to morality and whatever
mm-hmm.
else, they're not beholden to that kind of stuff because that's the ice cream, and now we're talking about insulin over here.
That's a great distinction. They don't think of religious truth claims as counting as real knowledge mm-hmm. the way that scientific truth in their minds would count as real knowledge. But to be fair, even to the other side of this, the Protestant side, to be fair to the Catholics, it's also present
yeah.
in the Protestant circles. Yeah. I was at a Southern Baptist church outside Atlanta recently, and I was told by a person in leadership that 30% of the core of that church was going to have a very hard time with what I would be speaking about mm-hmm. that day. And when I inquired as to what was meant by that, these were people who had been in the church for years. I said, well, how long have they been? Some of them 35, 40 years. Very, very left of center, and especially on moral issues.
Hmm.
And this is an SBC church, a Southern Baptist mm-hmm. church. So to be fair to our Catholic friends, we're not singling them out by saying that there are problems with people letting religion be whatever they want it to be. As you have well put it in one of your essays, they're basically eating religious stew. It means
right.
whatever you want it to
That's
be.
That's exactly right. So, yeah. I mean, this problem here is transdenominational, where you have people who are consistently living out the convictions. Mm-hmm. This is true in the Roman Church, and you have and the Protestant Church, and you have those that aren't. You know, they're
right.
just kind of going along for the ride. One other question here before we go on with our callers after our break. You said that even though there are some changes here, we see these polls, but you don't put a lot of confidence in that, because when it comes to the question of first and second trimester abortions, that the numbers have stayed largely the same. Are you suggesting then that by and large pro-lifers, these people don't understand the logic of the pro-life view, because later on in the development, when the mm-hmm. fetus looks more human, they're more sympathetic towards the pro-life view, and before that, when the fetus doesn't look human, the embryo, then they're more sympathetic towards the pro-choice view?
Well, the short answer, because we're due to go to break here, it looks like in about 30 seconds, but the short answer is
it's a soft break,
you have
so
philosophical people who are questioning the very foundation of human value. But then you have other people who say they believe the unborn are human, but they don't really believe it, because they would mm-hmm. never kill two-year-olds for the reasons they kill fetuses.
Right.
Those
right.
people we can persuade, and that's where showing them that the question comes down to what is the unborn is mm-hmm. absolutely essential.
And where your contribution is, even to my own life, and I think to a great degree to the movement, is using graphic visuals in an effective and principled fashion to help people see what's actually going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, showed them in a church service this morning, as a matter of fact.
Restoring
yeah.
meaning to the yeah. word abortion. Is your website for LTI Life Training Institute up and operating? Can people get to that?
ProLifeTraining.com, and they'll notice we're making changes. In fact, we're just about to launch our major retrofit coming up here, but
okay.
it's already starting to undergo. But stay with it. It's working.
Okay, ProLifeTraining.com.
ProLifeTraining.com.
And I just give a strong encouragement to those of you, our listeners, who not just pay lip service to the pro-life view, but also want to do something about it. The very least you can do, minimally, starting place, is to support financially people like Scott and his small team. Actually, he's carrying the lion's share of the work and works really hard. And I support Scott and LTI, and I want to encourage you to consider that too. LifeTraining.com.
ProLifeTraining.com.
ProLifeTraining.com. That's where you can get the details, and if they want to participate in your
yep.
organization. Get your newsletter, which always includes a training element,
mm-hmm.
you know, not only just your schedule and what you're doing, but he has a commitment to train you as well in this whole area. Scott, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you again, Greg. Thanks for letting me drop in.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice treat for me. All right, coming up next, your calls, and we've got a lot of them right here on Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions, from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and Is One Way the Only Way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON, or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR.
Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
That was kind of a nice treat to have Scott on board. The show is Stand to Reason, friends, and now it's your turn. Looking forward to talking with you. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go right to the calls. In fact, our first call, let me get the right button here, is from Mannheim, Germany. Andrew, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello.
Hello, sir. Are you American in Germany, or are you a German calling an American?
I am an American in Germany.
Okay. Are you military?
Okay, I am.
Well, thank you for your service.
I haven't done anything yet.
Well, I'm sure you've served. You just maybe haven't drawn any blood yet, and I hope you never will. But thank anyway, what's on your mind, Andrew?
My idea was to pose the question that someone gave to me and then give you how I answered that.
Okay.
And then you can kind of give me some pointers because, of course, the result wasn't satisfactory, and I'm wondering whether it was because of the person or whether it was because of my answer.
Okay. Of course, a lot depends on when you say satisfactory and what it was you were intending to accomplish, but why don't you give me the question, and I'll do my best, and we'll hear from you, too.
Well, the question was, what is the purpose of marriage, or why marry?
All right. As usual, I have a couple of questions just for clarification so I know that I'm answering the question you're asking. All right. So when the person says, why get married, that could be a different question than what is the purpose of marriage. The purpose of marriage is determined by the purposer. All right. Why a person gets married, the purposer, that is the one who made marriage to begin with. Why one gets married could be a totally different kind of answer. That would be, what would be the personal motivations that might cause me to get married? So the question, as it came up, at least in conversation with you, was it of the first or the second or how?
That could be part of the difficulty in answering it. It was just a Facebook comment. And then, of course, a string of comments and other people putting in, and then I put in my 2 cents.
Okay, well, let me just give you my initial reaction when I saw the question come up in the card that Melinda put up. Okay. Why get married? The first thing that I thought of was, so you can have sex. Now, what's connected to that, I mean, since this isn't just an Epicurean impulse here by me, what's connected to that is because then sex produces children. So marriage is the institution in which you can have sex on a regular basis in a relationship of deepening intimacy, which is the kind of relationship where sex is most satisfying, and you are in a position to raise the children that are the natural consequence of that behavior. In a way that, and I'm speaking in generalizations here, in a way that generally protects the children that are birthed in that process. Now, there's more that I could say about it. The first thing that came to mind was sex, and what the children are the consequence of sex, and oftentimes the goal of sex. And two couples who are married and have children is what family is at its core, and family is a foundation, the foundation stone of civilization. So there is a one reason to get married is so that you can have a family. Now, can you procreate without getting married? Sure, people do it all the time, but that's not a family. That's just sperm donors. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is those children, oftentimes that are the result of that, are either killed through abortion or neglected because the father, in this case, is not there to care as he ought and as they deserve. Mm-hmm. So marriage becomes an institution that creates an environment where the best sex can be had and the children, which are the natural result, not always the goal, immediate goal, but the natural result of sex, then can be reared. I mean, that to me is pretty straightforward. Now, there is more to it than that. You also have a deepening relationship with a member of the opposite sex, your spouse, that brings enrichment to your life, as do the children. Neither is consistently fun. I don't think you should get married to have fun, because, or have kids to have fun, because it isn't fun.
Right.
Neither of those is fun because they're demanding. You are no longer living for yourself. You're living for other people. Now, there are times when it's fun, but you don't get married for fun.
Right.
You get married for richness and depth and other valuable things that are much more weighty than merely fun.
Correct. And which is, I didn't even think about the sex part so much, but I kind of jumped in my answer. I jumped right to the whole children part. But the whole, you're talking about fun and everything, my answer was in effect, and see if you can follow me, see if this is a good example. I likened marriage similar to what each male has to decide when he turns 18 and when he wants to vote. He has to do what? He has to register with the Selective Service,
mm-hmm.
which is basically trading a voice in a society for also the possibility of having to be called up and drafted in
mm-hmm.
that society.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a benefit of being able to, you know, have your, you know, voice and the rights that are protected by society and so on and government.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also that responsibility
right.
of being drafted. And well, you have to kind of really, you should think about that.
Yeah, but well, then, I like the benefits responsibility a portion of this. I think a little bit of the liability is it's not so cogent to people, that using that illustration, is not so cogent to people because there is no effective draft, even though they have to register. It doesn't go any further than that. Not like when I was at high school and turned 18. I mean, there was a draft back then. It was 1968.
Right.
And secondly is you are identifying an appropriate relationship between the benefits of regular sexual expression and intimacy with the responsibility of caring for other people, the spouse and the children that eventuate from that relationship. But that is not the way a lot of people see it nowadays. They think they can get the sex for free
right.
without any responsibility. And I think that's the way a lot of people look at it. They say, well, I don't need to get married to have sex.
Exactly.
I don't need to take care of kids either.
The problem when the person that actually asking this question is a person that has been living for some years now with her lover
mm-hmm.
and describes the relationship as very unconditional love,
mm-hmm.
and she just doesn't see any reason to get married.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a Christian, so I'm not going to pressure her to
right,
get married.
Right.
She doesn't
well,
have any desire to have kids.
Of course, that is a de facto marriage, you know, in a sense.
Right.
If it's a long-term committed relationship, whether they walk down the aisle and get a license, in some ways is in. You know, probably inconsequential to that particular relationship. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't get married. It doesn't really matter, because I do think it does. I think that making the public commitment – I've talked to people who said, well, we're fully committed. I said, you're not as committed to each other as if you were to walk down the aisle in front of your community, the people that are closest to you, and commit yourself to each other and implicitly are holding – are inviting the rest of that community to hold you accountable to that decision.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. You can get quote-unquote married in private, which is what this implicit relationship is of the young lady who you're referring to, and therefore easily get married in private through this kind, and easily get unmarried, and nobody's going to be the wiser, pretty much.
Right.
It's a lot more difficult when you make this commitment public, which I think is the point. Part of the point, and now I'm just looking from a cultural perspective. One of the reasons that cultures celebrate this event is so that you have marriage, is so that you have cultural support, you have community support and involvement in the stability of that relationship, which is the relationship that as a rule produces children, produces the next generation, which the entire culture is concerned about.
Right. But it seems, well, it's a sad thing, it seems our culture is getting more and more questioning I just saw a part of a movie today where the man was talking to his partner who had been living together for quite some time now, on the issue of why they weren't married, and he says, why do I need to go pay the state $45 or whatever so that they can give us a certificate of our friendship?
Well, that isn't the purpose of it. The purpose of a marriage in that sense is to celebrate the union before the community and enter into the and as participants in the community in a kind of official way as a couple. So we're an item, we're a member, we are seeking the community's affirmation of our relationship. Now, it may be true that the individual in this movie doesn't feel he needs that. Well, he doesn't need it for him if he is thinking of his relationship in a purely selfish regard. If he is thinking of himself as a member of a community, which I think it's appropriate to do, well, then it does have a different kind of importance. So I think there is a benefit to that, and I can understand why people, especially schooled on the philosophy of the last 30 years or 40 years now, since the counterculture in this country, why they wouldn't be compelled to seek that kind of union. But I think in the long term, it creates a better, more stable relationship, particularly for children who are brought into this world and need long-term care. Not just two or three or four years, but, you know, a lifetime of care in order for the family to be a stabilizing influence of the culture at large. And to the degree that that particular thing, the family unit, is undermined, well, the rest of the culture suffers as well.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's hard to convince people of my generation take care of our of the future kind of. That kind of like community feeling. There's more and more. I think my generation, we're kind of getting isolationist. We're kind of like.
How old are you, Andrew?
I'm 27.
Yeah, because you know, the so-called postmodern generation is supposed to be the generation that cares about relationships and community. You know, I'd be curious, and you're a little bit on the older side of the postmodern generation, maybe. I don't know, but you're not far away from it. You know, it isn't like you're 18, but still, you're part of this generation that comes after the counterculture movement, and I see that as principally postmodern. So, this is supposed to be one of their values, and I'm wondering how it's playing out in general.
I think it's
in terms of those relationships.
In practicality, it seems that we more just care about ourselves. We could care less about whether our values get carried on, and or whether the next people coming after us have a intact environment or whatever. You know, the passing on kind of sentiment.
Well, you might ask and this is part of an ongoing conversation probably you're having with different people, but you might ask them, you know, what on their mind is the value of marriage. And what responsibility do they think that they as a couple have to the rest of the community? Are they isolated people that are just – that their only responsibility is to themselves and their own pleasures? Or do they have a larger responsibility to their community? And do they have a responsibility, a long-term responsibility to their children that would be born of this relationship? So, I mean, these are things you might want to ask.
Those are good questions.
Andrew, good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Auf Wiedersehen. From Mannheim, Germany. Let's see. Where are we break-wise? Let's take the next call. And let's go to Chris in Lake Forest. Chris, Greg Kokel. Glad you called. Hi.
Hi, Greg. Wow, do you still get nervous whenever you get on the radio?
No, not usually. Depends. Not usually. I got nervous the first 4 or 5 months. It was hard, especially the first few weeks, because I didn't know what I was going to say, and I didn't entirely know how to say it, and I didn't know if anybody was going to call me. But, you know, I've kind of gotten past that, and I have more things to say if nobody calls, so it's made it easier.
Yeah. Well, no, I was just saying that just because every single time I call you, I just get incredibly nervous.
Oh.
I try to compose myself there.
Well, that's okay. You sound fine to me, so you had me fooled.
Well, thanks. I called last Father's Day towards the end of the show, and unfortunately, I didn't have enough time to develop a conversation with you regarding the question I brought up.
Okay.
Which was assuming the definition of free will that you affirm, that we're free to choose within our nature, but that's always opposed to God. How would God be justified in punishing someone who doesn't have moral freedom? And last week, I managed to hear the illustration you leveraged from the movie Taken for the necessity of Jesus' save us from our captive state. But it's interesting because I think your illustration fails by the same criteria you gave me during our last conversation regarding a similar illustration that I was trying to give, in that it's not an external force that is inhibiting us in our ability to choose God, but rather our own will forcing us.
Oh, and, yeah. Well, definitely in the movie Taken, that clearly in the movie, the thing that was holding Kim, one of the characters in the mill, captive, was an external force. So I fully admit that it is, the illustration is discontinuous at that point, because my point is that the thing that holds us captive principally is our own rebellion against God and an act of our own will. My point with the illustration is to say that the captivity, though, in practical terms, is no less thoroughgoing when we are our own captors, as it were, than if somebody else were captivated us. We are still need to be rescued by a champion. So I admit that the parallel breaks down significantly. But in terms of a realist characterization, not using parallels, I mean, I would stand behind my characterization that it is man's will that is against human person's will that is against God, and they don't come to him not because someone else is holding them back, but because they are unwilling in virtue of their nature to go to him. And that's the particular question you want to explore, as I understand it, right?
Yeah, that's basically it. And I think that the reason why oftentimes the illustrations fail us is because we don't really have anything like it to compare to. Because if we are restraining...
Wait, Chris, hold on just a second, because I have to go to break, and I'll come back to you. And then maybe I'll suggest some illustrations after you have your say that might be more parallel. Hold on there. I'll be back in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species, and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Talking with Chris in Lake Forest about an issue that I actually think is one of the more theologically tricky and morally tricky kinds of issues, and that has to do with the responsibility that we have before God for rebellion against him when, in fact, we are born into that condition. And that's the issue you're raising, Chris. Did you want to expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, I think the last thing really is, before we took the break, what I was going to say was that if we are restraining ourselves and if there's no external force that's acting on us, then I would say that we have made a choice, and that choice would be that we're suppressing ourselves from acknowledging the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Or else the word will wouldn't be a rational part of the picture. But if there's nothing forcing us from the outside but our own natures, which will not choose God, then that in itself is forcing us, especially if we had nothing to do with it. It's imposing a disposition where we cannot choose him. So I'm just trying to understand how God can hold me accountable for that.
Okay, well, that's a second question, but I'm listening to your words, though. If our natures impose themselves on us so that we cannot choose him is the kind of language you've used. And I'm just going to, at least from my part, insist on different language, and you can reject it if you want. But I think the way you've expressed it kind of takes one and makes the one into two. And so you have effectively created an outside force, and that outside force being one's own nature, which is holding someone captive so that one can't choose. But in fact, the nature is one's self, or it is an aspect of one's self. It's not two, but all the same one. And the nature is the place from which the will springs. When one decides when one exercises his will, that is an expression of his nature, which is in rebellion against God, it is that person that is making his choices that are consistent with what he wants. So what I want to insist on is that it isn't an outside thing. It is the one himself who will not do otherwise. So now, whether or not, pardon me?
Oh, I'm sorry, but constrained by the nature, and that's where I see that being the external part that's pushing us down. Okay. It's that nature which will only allow us to choose against God. And if God is going to be judging us for those decisions, if we are restricted by a nature that can only choose bad choices, then I'm not doing this to just be a devil's advocate. I'm really evaluating Reformed theology.
No, I appreciate that. So the second question, I think, is more substantive, second part of it. We'll move on to that second part now, but I just want to kind of go on record to say that I don't think that making two out of the one is a legitimate way to do it. But be that as it may, even if you agreed with my characterization that it is still their will that is choosing, even so, since their nature is such, how can they be held responsible by God for having a nature that inevitably results in rebellion to him? And I think that's the more thorny question. Well, let me ask you a question here, and I'll do my best to answer. I think that's harder to respond to, but what would be the alternatives? I mean, what alternative do you think might present itself that would be a reasonable possibility here if you reject this as the reality of the matter?
Well, I think
I don't think it's just Reformed theology that holds this view. That's why. So go ahead.
Oh, okay. I think what I was saying when I called on Father's Day was that towards the end, if we could at least be aware or acknowledge the situation we're in. There's nothing that I'm not trying to say that it's Pelagian, that there's something that we can do, that we can always make the right choices. But if at least I can become aware of the situation and the nature that I'm in, and then make the decision whether or not I will continue along with that nature, or if I will choose God's grace and his pardon for me, then I think that God would be justified in holding me accountable for that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, I have seen the truth. Now, it's my choice to reject it or to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I become, I guess,
culpable,
morally
right.
responsible or
mm-hmm.
culpable for that decision,
right, right.
to where eternal damnation or God's, or heaven would be a just punishment or reward.
Okay. My two responses to that is the first one is, as I read Scripture, I don't think that that option is consistent with the way Scripture describes our circumstances. So that's one issue. Now, if I mean, that doesn't mean you got to believe it just because. But I think that if you're working within with a high view of Scripture, I don't think that you're going to find the option you described as being consistent with what the Scripture says about the problem with man, including Romans, especially Romans 5, but other places as well. So that to me is one difficulty, since I have a commitment to Scripture in understanding these kinds of things. The second thing, though, is meant to address what seems to be the moral imbalance of that equation, and that is that part of the problem here, part of the issue is that we are being treated not as individuals, but as part of a larger group by God. We are identified with a group, and the group itself is condemned. And since the group is condemned, the individuals in the group are condemned. Your complaint is that, and understandably, well, the individual in the group maybe didn't earn the condemnation that falls to the group. Maybe Adam did that, if you will. I'm sympathetic to that observation, yet at the same time, we seem to operate even as human beings with a group identification mentality in which the group or those acting for the groups, bring approbation upon not only themselves but the group at large, and it seems appropriate to lay that to the individuals in the group. For example, when heads of state declare war on each other, then all the members of the country are at war with each other. And even though there might be a sense, certainly, that the individual American GI doesn't have a beef with the individual Japanese GI in the Second World War, still they are part of a group and they are fighting each other and they inflict damage on each other in a way that seems, when most people reflect on it, as maybe tragic, but at the same time morally appropriate because you're part of the larger group. And so the group is the one who has, and therefore the members of the group secondarily have this approbation applying to them. So the Japanese are at war with the Americans, and the Americans at war with the Japanese. And so one fight the other. When we talk about reparations, like for slavery, no one who caused the harm to slaves is alive today. So there's no way the individual could make reparations for it. But there does seem to be a sense, at least in the minds of many people, where a country can have a responsibility to a group of people. That is, so one group of people, the country, can have responsibility to another group of people, that is a racial group, subset of that country, such that even though neither of those groups were participants in the original crime, there does seem to be a responsibility that flows, and therefore one takes responsibility for the problems of the past by paying reparations. The same thing is true in treaties. When people make treaties with countries, it's the country and therefore the people in the country that are responsible for that treaty. Even if a generation has passed and the original people are no longer existing, there are still responsibilities that seem to accrue. I'm just citing these as examples where it seems to make sense to talk about the responsibilities falling to the group, even when the individuals in the group don't all participate in the original thing. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So I find that, and by the way, this notion is really true in the Bible, because when you look at God's dealings with Israel, he deals with Israel as a nation. He doesn't deal necessarily with each individual person on their own merits. So when Israel as a nation is obeying God, then Israel as a nation is getting God's blessing, even though there are individuals that are not obeying him. And the opposite is true. If you remember in 1 Kings 19, when Elisha goes to Mount Sinai and he's all depressed and he's saying, "Oh, I alone am left," kind of thing. And God says, "Well, wait, there's still 6,000 people or whatever that have not bowed their knee to Baal. I still have my faithful remnant, but they are all being disciplined as a group. When God doesn't send rain for 3.5 years, everybody suffers, even the people that are the good ones, because they're part of the larger group with which God is dealing." And I think that prefigures this concern that we're talking about here that we see in more detail in Romans 5. But I can understand how, especially for Americans who are much more individualistic in their approach to things, how this can be uncomfortable to think about it. And I'll confess that I'm uncomfortable with it as well. I just feel personally committed to it because I think that's a teaching of Scripture. And so this is why I'm reaching for some of these other examples of the kind of the group responsibility or group identification with a group that seem to make sense even to us apart from religious issues in the Bible. So what do you think?
Oh, no, I agree with that. I would say the only thing, I guess the first thing that popped in my mind when we started studying the Old Testament was when Lot pleaded with God over, you know, well, what if there's 50, 40, 30, 10?
Well, there you have the exact same thing going, but in the reverse, where the multitude is rescued because of the righteousness of the few. In other words, it's the few that are the righteous in that scenario. Now, it turned out there weren't even 10 righteous. But had there been 10 righteous, then the multitudes would have been saved. So it's in a sense just the reverse. You know, it isn't like the good people get caught up with the bad in God's judgment. It's just the other way around. God would have saved the bad for the sake of the good. But notice the motif is still there. It's the exact same motif.
Where
God's dealing with the group. You're just dealing with the difference, you know, the minority instead of the majority in that case. Is that what you thought of at the time?
Oh, well, no, it was the first thing that popped up, but I see how it fits into your characterization as well.
Yeah.
I guess,
do you remember when Achan was swallowed up? You know, he stole the gold there after the battle of Jericho, and so therefore they lost Ai, and they found out who's the bad guy who took the stuff that he wasn't supposed to take. Well, it's Achan who took it, but who got swallowed up?
Yeah,
it was Achan and his whole family, right? The tent and everything gets swallowed up by the ground, and boy, it scared everybody because there's again the identification with the group, in this case the family.
Yeah, well, I guess that's kind of interesting because when we die, are we going to be held accountable before God as a group together, or individually are we going to be judged by God? If it's going to be the group, then I would see there would be no individual judgment for any of us. It would just be mankind is all destined.
Yeah, I think the answer to that is a trick answer. For those of the redeemed, so to speak, we are judged as a group, but on the merits of Christ. I mean, which is an interesting wrinkle to this discussion, you know. If we fall under the merits of Christ, we are judged as a group by the merits of Christ. So that's the second Adam. By the first Adam, we're condemned, but by the second Adam, we're saved. But by the first Adam, we're condemned not just by the sin of Adam, and that's the identification of the group, but we are also condemned by our own individual works, which flow from the fact that we're fallen. So when you actually look at the great white throne judgment, though, in Revelations 20, what you see is the individual acts are itemized. So it is meant to demonstrate that every person judged by God is judged justly. So it's a combination, in a sense. In Adam, we are guilty, and in Adam, we are condemned, but we also are condemned by our own acts, which acts follow from the rebellion that we inherit from Adam. And those individual acts are acts that we're judged by.
Well, you know, within our own justice system, though, and this will be like the last thing I throw out.
Yeah, we got 20 seconds.
But in our own justice system, we do judge people's acts individually, even if they are part of a group, where we'll see people get different sentences based on their participation in the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And much of our jurisprudence derives itself from biblical ethics.
No, I appreciate that. The internal justice, that's true. But then we have these other elements of international justice where that doesn't apply. And so I think in the same sake, we have some of those notions with God. We're dealt with as a group, and then we're also dealt with as individuals. So I'm sympathetic to your concern, Chris, and I hope that, you know, some of the things I've offered have, you know, shed some light on. It's a very difficult issue, though, and I've struggled with it myself. Hour number two behind us. Hour number three coming right up on Stand to Reason.
15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Basic training for your mind, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you get on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel with you every Sunday from 2 until 5. That would be our live show. Some of you only get the last 2 hours, so this would be number 2 for you instead of number 3. Of course, you can get all 3 hours on our website, str.org. Download podcast, have it shipped directly to you. You can find our podcast on iPhone on the podcast page, so lots of easy ways to get that. And we count it a privilege to be a regular part of your life through this podcast, and to get you thinking about the things that are most important. As you know, my interest is not in just telling you what to think, though I'm glad to give you facts and information, but I am much more interested in helping you learn how to think more effectively. Not that I'm the perfect proponent of that. I make my own mistakes. But if we are intentional about the process and learn a little bit about how thinking actually works, then we will be better at it and, as a result, increase our stock of true beliefs and decrease our stock of bad ones, as my philosophy professor, Doug Guyvett, used to put it in epistemology class. But it's very practical. It's very practical if you can think better. And we are applying careful thinking to the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. And in particular, in defense of classical Christianity, classical Christian values. That's what this show is all about. But I've got a full bank of callers, so I'm just going to jump right in and get to you all as quickly as I can. This is Chris from Ohio. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
I'd like to say thanks for your training material. I've been calling the last couple of weeks about a paper I've been writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it back, and it was the highest grade anyone's gotten in my philosophy class.
No kidding.
So,
well, good for you. Congratulations.
The training on how to think is working.
I'm glad to hear that. I really am.
To extrapolate.
What was the? By the way, what was the paper about?
It was a response to an atheist, McCloskey's Australian philosopher, on being an atheist. Mm. And we had to respond to the arguments that he gave.
Okay. For atheism proper, is that right?
Right. Well, more so, he was undercutting the reasons for theism and then offered that atheism was a more comfortable worldview.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you know, that's a good point that you made. Most of the time, atheists do not give reasons for atheism. What they do is undercut reasons for theism and trying to show that then theism is not properly justified and therefore atheism is more the default view. Although it's interesting how you put it, it's the more comfortable view. And I guess in one sense of that, that's true. You know, it is more comforting, at least from one perspective, not to think that some divine being is looking over your shoulder all the time. There are some downsides that are not so comforting about that, but okay, I understand.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind, Chris?
In my paper, I kind of touched on what you said in the Answering the Problem of Evil presentation that you gave about raising the problem of evil ultimately leads you back to the issue of grounding and may actually be a strong proof for the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I was questioning if we should stop at evil, then also as the atheist to ground the concept of God being all loving, mm-hmm. which is something they say is in contradiction with the existence of evil. So that in order for them to even make sense of God being all loving, they would need to ground that as well. Would you say that was
okay? So you see this rejoinder that I've offered and others have offered, which is really the moral argument for the existence of God, is that if there is true evil in the world, then there must be true good and of a transcendent nature, and such true good, transcendent good, requires a grounding, a transcendently good being that is the foundation for that. And there, you're saying you could add a second, you know, punch to that. So you got a 1-2 punch now, saying that there are also atheists who talk about if God is really a God of love, then, you know, whatever, then love also requires a grounding. if I understand
it. Right, and whether or not they can ground that in their worldview. If it can, and love just turns out to be some kind of biochemical effect, then raising the charge of, you know, the contradiction between all loving and
okay, people. I'm not sure if it's going to work the same way, maybe for two reasons. Here's the first one. Generally, the moral argument for the existence of God says you are complaining about the problem of evil, but in order to complain about the problem of evil, there's got to be a good God to ground it. So morality has to exist. God has to exist. There is a way around that for the atheist, but it is not the way that most atheists take. The way around it is for them to simply say, well, I am not saying there's real evil in the world. On your worldview, God is good and there is evil in the world, and how do you make those two fit? So here is a little different nuance to the challenge from the atheist, and they are simply looking at the internal structure, the internal logic of our view, and without making any commitments themselves to the existence of evil or good, they are simply saying that our system has these pieces in it that seem to be at odds with each other. Now, that's a more sophisticated way of stating the problem, and it is an end around the issue that you and I were just discussing, the grounding right. problem, because they don't have to ground something that they don't believe in.
Right.
All they need to do is to point to what they think is a contradiction in what we believe in. Now, to solve the problem, by the way, for us, all we have to show is that there's no internal contradiction between those notions.
Right.
Now, as a matter of fact, when people complain about the problem of evil, usually they're pointing to evil and not just looking at the internal contradiction. And if they're pointing to genuine evil, if they're saying, look at these examples of religious evil or whatever, natural evil, then they, I think, are compromised in the way that your and my arguments have taken advantage of. Okay.
Right.
Now, with regards to love, then, they might simply say, without acknowledging transcendent love, they might just be simply saying, well, on your view, there is a God of transcendent love, and that seems to require, on your view, this kind of situation, and so there may be a contradiction. So one way they can get around the love thing is not by owning love themselves, but simply pointing to it in our system and say that creates problems.
Right.
Now, I suspect that most atheists believe in love, but I think they might... I think love is different than morality, because morality entails an evaluation, and evaluations require standards. And that's where the moral argument for the existence of God comes from. I think love requires a standard, but it's an entirely different kind of standard. Just like when you say, well, here's a glass of water that's, 47 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that requires a standard, but that you can see easily how the standard can be determined just in purely materialistic terms, and there doesn't need to be any transcendent grounding for, the way we describe the temperature of water. And in fact, it's really subjective, because you could describe the temperature in centigrade or Fahrenheit, and it's a different measurement.
Right.
It might be that someone can do the same kind of thing with love. They could say, well, what love, they could just describe it behaviorally, or they could describe it emotionally, if you're talking about the texture of a feeling. And in that regard, as long as someone is having the feeling that fulfills, or having the experience or the behaviors that fulfill that definition, then I think you're safe to say that that's an example of love. Just like you could say that this is tepid water. Because we have an agreement as to what that means. Now, I think it's going to be more difficult if your notion of love entails a moral concept, like treating people a certain way. And if a moral notion is being smuggled in, then you do need grounding, but not because love needs grounding, but because the moral notion associated with love needs grounding, and that was the issue you talked about initially.
Right. Can I tell you kind of where I got this
sure,
from?
Sure, because I could maybe be mistaken on this, and maybe it might be that the notion of love needs a transcendent grounding, so I'm open to that.
Well, I was listening to William Lane Craig's portion of it, and he corrected the misunderstanding that the purpose of humanity is not for their own personal happiness, but to know God and enjoy Him forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of took an ambiguous term and clarified what was meant by it, so that
the chief end of man. Is that what you're referring to?
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a more appropriate definition.
Yeah, well, that certainly would be an accurate answer given the Christian worldview. Right.
Right. Because it seems like, I mean, at that point, the atheist was talking about something different than what we meant concerning the Christian view.
Okay. Yeah, and if you're going to critique a view and find a fault with the view, you have to find a fault with the view itself and not with your own interpretation of the view.
Right.
Yeah.
So with something like love, and you say, well, like, and usually the atheist gives an example of something horrible that happened and said, well, you know, loving God allows to happen. And so my suspicion is then, well, what exactly are you defining as love? Because some things that happen in life, the atheist would say, well, that's not all loving. And it's almost reminiscent of kind of what a spoiled child says.
Right.
Parent punishes someone, he's like, oh, you don't love me. Well, no, I mean, you're just spoiled. This is an act of love, though you may not like it.
Right. No, okay, this is a very good point, and I hinted at a response to it just a moment ago, so let me say it in other terms. If they're going to say that our God is not loving, they can't say so in attacking our view unless they're using our definition of love. If they're using their definition of love, it's a non-starter, it seems to me, because you can't fault the internal consistency of a viewpoint by importing your own ideas into it and creating the conflict, basically, by definition.
Can I ask you just one
actually, Chris, I've got
before
four,
I go up there?
I've got four more calls on. I really need to get to them. But if you want to call back next week, I'd be glad to talk with you a little bit more.
Okay.
Okay, and Chris, congratulations on your paper. Good for you. Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go to Sake in Seattle. Is this the Sake from last week or the week before?
Yeah, this is the same person.
Okay.
How's it going, Greg?
I'm doing fine. Nice to talk to you again, Sake.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you. Before I ask this question, and actually my question seems a lot less cool than the rest of the calls, so.
Well, you got to stick with the issue that you gave to the enforcer. That's
I will, don't worry, I will. Before I ask that, though, I just realized that you bear a slight resemblance to Clint Eastwood. Maybe you don't agree with that, but I just noticed
I bear, you mean a physical resemblance?
Yes, I mean a physical resemblance to Clint Eastwood.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a compliment. You know, just for
yeah, good, I mean, I
he's a bit older than I am, you know, so, I'm thinking of his, what was his name?
In, right.
Remember when he was in Gunsmoke, but Rawhide. He was Rowdy James or something like that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
well, so I'm going to take it as that was the time when he resembled me. Okay, I'll take it.
Yes, I mean in a very good way.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, here's my, and maybe you can help me. It's more of an opinion, I guess. What would you say, I guess, what would be the significance of, like, secondary issues? Like, for instance, okay, and by secondary issues, I
mean... You mean theological
exactly,
issues.
Exactly, yeah. Like, at what point, like, when you critique things like prosperity doctrine or, like, women pastors or, you know, questionable reinterpretations of a well-established doctrine...
Okay.
That maybe aren't... It's not like you're denying the divinity of Jesus or something like that.
Okay,
but...
Well, okay, how do I distinguish between the two? What is there a dividing?
How you distinguish, but how would you go about addressing maybe something that you have a serious concern about, but that may not be critical to, in your view, someone's salvation? Does that kind
okay.
of make sense?
Yeah, sure. There's a difference
okay.
between being heretical and heterodox. Okay.
Yeah, okay, I've never even heard that word, actually.
Okay, heretical, I mean, the way I'm using the term, a person
uh-huh.
who is a heretic isn't somebody who just believes something wrong. He believes something wrong spiritually that is so wrong that it is outside the pale of Christianity.
Okay?
So if you deny the deity of Christ, it turns out that the deity of Christ is what might be called a sine qua non of Christianity. That's Latin phrase, which means that without which. So if you don't have this thing that is a sine qua non, it isn't the same thing anymore. You've removed an essential feature. So an essential feature to Christianity, classically construed, would be the
okay.
deity of Christ.
Yeah.
And if you believed in Jesus but you didn't think he was God, you might be a real nice person and you might have a really sweet religion and you may even be right for the sake of discussion, but you're not Christian. Okay. So a heretical view is a view in which there is a denial of a defining element of Christianity. Now, you can be a Christian, though, and be wrong about a whole bunch of things. They are not orthodox in that they are exactly the way, the truth of the Bible, but they are heterodox. They are other than orthodox, but they are not enough to take you out of the game entirely. So whether or not you baptize, let's just say there is a correct answer about the second coming of Christ.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he's going to come back before the millennial kingdom, and then there's a millennial kingdom at which he rules, and that's the way it works out. Maybe he comes back after the millennial kingdom, so it's not a pre-mill return of Christ, it's a post-mill return of Christ, or maybe uh-huh. some other option. But you could, so not everybody in that discussion can be right,
uh-huh.
but they can still have varying views and still be broadly within the faith, as it were,
yeah.
Because they hold to the defining views of Christianity, the defining items. So I might be Reformed, you might be Arminian, but we can uh-huh. still both be Christian, even though we have this variation. So that's the distinction that I would make between heterodoxy and heresy.
Okay.
All right.
And then if I could insert one more micro question, I know you don't have a whole lot of time, but would you say there are any secondary issues that are, like you said, not heretical, but are kind of like red flags maybe? Like, could you give up something major like inerrancy?
Well, inerrancy is not really a doctrine of
yeah,
Christianity.
Yeah, I realize that. I
In the same sense. I mean, it doesn't show
yeah.
up on any of the creeds or
creed,
anything
yeah.
like that. But there seems to be a practical consideration, because once that the Bible becomes something less than the inspired Word of God, and maybe some people aren't comfortable with using inerrant, but something like the very words of God, God's specific and authoritative revelation to man, once it becomes less than that, then it's very hard to maintain any of the other points of orthodoxy.
I see.
So there's a practical consideration there. But your question was, I mean, apart from the inerrancy, you're asking, are there some things that are heterodox that are still really serious?
Yeah.
Errors?
I guess maybe, is there something that you would see or that
yeah,
could
I would,
lead? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say the word faith, yes, there are heterodox errors, which
uh-huh.
is kind of a redundancy, but there are, you know, there are errors that, though they may not be heretical in the sense that they remove you from Christianity wholesale, they are still really, really, really bad. I think the
uh-huh.
word faith movement, I think that there are people who believe certain tenets of the word faith movement, not the Christological aspects, like who is
yeah.
Jesus and who is God, but maybe just the notion that, you know, name it and claim it, that I think is seriously injurious to Christianity, but I
yeah,
think
I
they
agree.
Can hold that and still be saved,
yeah.
if you want to use that language. So, so there's a full range of things, and we talk about a lot of things here that are problems in Christianity that have serious ramifications, even though the people that hold them are still brothers and sisters in the Lord.
Right.
So the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but want to have their ears tickled. And,
very good, yeah.
Yeah, you know, 2 Timothy chapter 4.
Yeah,
so
some
of those who are getting their ears tickled are getting their ears tickled with heresy, and they're believing it, and that takes them right out of the kingdom, or keeps them out of the kingdom, as the case may be. And others are getting their ears tickled with some really dangerous nonsense, but they, you know, they'll still, you know, make it in as though by fire. As it were. Okay, partner?
Yeah, thank you very much. It was good to talk to you.
Good talking to you, Sake. A break coming up here, and then we'll have more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness? Or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions, from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and Is One Way the Only Way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Christianity you can sink your teeth into. That's what I like to think about what we do here on Sundays, 2 until 5 on Stand to Reason. Let's go to Elena. Let me find your button here, Elena. Elena, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
All righty. I just wanted to comment real quick. I caught the tail end of what Scott Klusendorf was saying. I've had the privilege, actually, of hearing him speak with his defense of the pro-life position.
It is a privilege. He's a singular individual, and you're right.
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty incredible. I just wanted to comment. I'm a Catholic, and he's spot on about the divide within the church of voters. And it was the topic of conversation. I actually just spent 5.5 months in Europe studying, and you know, it was still the topic of emails between my mother and I and many, many pro-life friends who, when I was in the States during the fall, still would not vote for a pro-life candidate because of other, like Scott mentioned, the social justice issues.
Well, what would they – I'm curious, since you're on the inside, you know, let me pick your mind just a little bit on this one. What would they consider first, discursus here, I object to the phrase social justice because I think in most cases it's misleading because
Absolutely.
The issues that they're identifying are not issues of justice at all. However, it would apply to the abortion issue. So what are the issues that they call social justice issues that could possibly trump the abortion issue, particularly if one who's, you know, in this, holding this other view is, believes that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being. I mean, which is, I presume, are the people that you're talking with.
Right, absolutely. I think that's a very, very valid question. Like you mentioned, the war is obviously an issue that comes into play, but other issues, I guess, more tangible that, you know.
So they're thinking that more lives are being lost, more innocent people are being killed without proper justification in the war in Iraq than are being killed by abortion? Is that what they're thinking?
I think in some cases, yes.
Because the numbers don't add up. Well, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. I think also though on a more concrete level, I mean, I don't know how abortion isn't concrete, but
well, it would be not concrete to them probably because they don't see the babies being killed.
Well, no. These are individuals who are completely or 100% abortion, no abortion in any circumstances,
okay.
But who still grappled with more of the issues of spending government dollars, helping programs for the poor, helping women, battered women, at-risk women, you know, more of government programs helping the underprivileged, with focus more on issues of immigration. and like I already mentioned, issues of the war, how those became.
Yeah, it's just so confused to me, though, Elena, and maybe you share my frustration, but this is I think, a common rut for people to fall into. I mean, let me give an illustration. So you and I are sitting in a restaurant, and there's a poor man outside the restaurant, okay? I reach into your purse, and I take your money, and I give it to him. You can't resist me because I'm bigger than you. Now, is it loving for me to take that money and give it to that man?
No, yeah.
No, is it loving for you? Have you done an act of love? No, there's no love here at all. All there is a transfer of money against one's will by force. That's it. And so this thing about helping the poor and battered women, all of this is all sanitized because I guarantee you the people, I can almost guarantee you the people that are campaigning for this kind of thing are not digging down deep in their own pockets to give to the poor. They're happy to vote for people who will use government power to take the money from somebody else so they don't have to do it.
Yeah.
And
no,
then they argue that this is somehow more pro-life than standing against abortion, which actually takes a life of an innocent human being every single time it's performed.
Oh. Absolutely. I mean, I agree 100%.
Yeah.
I think it's fostering an attitude of complacency. And as my friend Megan put it, she said if we just all learned what charity actually meant, you know, mm-hmm. we could avoid so much of this, of misuse of money, and really, mm-hmm. if we, you know...
By the way,
oh my gosh.
Not only this, I mean, that was just focusing on one moral aspect of the transfer of funds, but their response, even if the transfer of funds is a moral and loving thing, it presumes that all of those people that you just cited, that they're concerned about, are actually better off through a great society system than if there weren't these kinds of things. And I have no reason to believe that's the case. In fact, quite a few reasons to believe that all of these people are worse off as a class because of the government involvement, not better off.
Oh, yeah. I actually go to school in New Orleans, and that's been a big thing with post-Katrina relief mm-hmm. and the things that have gotten done in the city. You know, 9 times out of 10, people tell you, no, government didn't help me.
Mm-hmm.
It was Catholic Charities. It was Habitat for Humanity.
Right.
It was the superstar who came in with all of their dollars and was
sure.
able to direct where their funds were.
Brad Pitt, you know.
He's
been there, I understand, and good for him, you know, and I'm glad for that. But notice it's the private sector there. It's not the public sector redistributing wealth.
I wanted to say thank you in a – I think you'll appreciate this story. So when I mentioned I was studying in Europe for the past 5.5
mm-hmm.
months.
Whereabouts, by the way?
I was in Madrid.
Spain. Mm-hmm.
And so for my final paper for my language class, our teacher tells us, I want you to write me a paper on a controversial issue. That was it. Gave mm-hmm. us the liberty to choose whatever we wanted to do, talk about whatever issue we wanted. And, you know, I thought, wow.
By
what
the
an
way,
opportunity.
Was this a secular school?
Yeah, it was a secular school.
Okay.
Fantastic, the Spanish language teacher. I learned so much with him.
Good.
And I said, okay, this is it. I'm going to write the defense of the pro-life position in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And I start, you know, emailing frantically people back at my home institution, you know,
uh-huh.
where we did a training with, you know, the DVDs that you have out, and nobody was responding to me. So I just happened to get onto iTunes and subscribe to your podcast. And lo and behold, how providential could it be that the first podcast I got was about you talking about the unborn and the defense of the pro-life position.
Hmm.
So I start seriously taking notes, and somebody ends up responding to me with, you know, their notes on all your training. And
mm-hmm.
I ended up, you know, my roommate kept telling me, why are you spending so much time on this paper? You know, it'll be okay. You don't have to write as much. I was like, no, this means so much to me. And it's not just for this class, something I want to write as a resource to take back with me to the States,
mm-hmm.
especially being originally from Texas, where the Hispanic population is just continuing to grow.
Of course, there's not much in Spanish. So people have asked us about translation, you know, of our own material. So I'm glad you're able to have at it.
Yeah, so I did. And it was not only a good lesson to learn from a language perspective, but also one to learn of, oh, wow, like, thank you, God, for giving me the chance to
mm-hmm.
to write this out, to bang out a resource.
So what was the response from the instructor?
That's a great question, because things run a lot slower in Spain than they do here in the States, and I haven't really heard from them yet.
So you haven't got your grades back yet, huh?
No, I got my grade, my overall grade back in the class, which I did very, very well in the class. But I didn't get really any feedback on the paper. I don't think anybody did in the class.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you never know.
Yeah, I never knew.
Yeah, but, you know, I'll just tell you one thing, and final comment here, Elena. You know, you penned that piece and you sent it out. And the fact is, much of our impact as human beings in the world, we will never know. And it is always a delight for me, like is happening right now, for someone for whom I didn't know or didn't know that I was having an impact through a podcast on. You're touching base with me saying, look, this is what God did through what you provided. And I'm convinced that for you and many of our other listeners who have been faithful with what God has given them, that there are stories like that that apply to them that they'll never hear of as well. And this may be one of those. You send your paper, you cast your bet on the water, as it were, with this paper that you poured your heart and your mind into. And I'm going to trust that God is really going to use it in some special way.
Well, I sure hope so. Thank you so much for all your help.
You're welcome. All the best, and God keep you.
I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Bye-bye now. I was trying to think of a nice Spanish exit there, and my mind went blank. I guess I could have said adios, but it didn't seem to really fit the gravity of the moment. Nice talking with you, Elena. All right, let's go to Terrence in Davis. I thought it was Torrance for a minute in Southern California, but that's Terrence in Davis, California. Terrence, welcome to the show.
Hello, Greg.
Hi.
Hi. I was on the internet, and I ran across one of your talks at, I think, UCLA, where you discussed moral relativism.
Yeah, that was Veritas Forum, and that was a number of years ago, before the gray, I think. Before the gray hair is what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, I understood your argument on why if morals were subjective, then they really don't exist at all.
Right.
So you gave an argument for why morals are objective. And I think you said that we know morals are objective by intuition. And could you please explain that? Because I accept that the logic that morals are objective, I just don't understand how people could come to know that. Because I think socialization, people accept the standards of the community around them, but
I think that's sometimes true. There is an influence of socialization. There's no question about that in my mind. The question is whether socialization is ultimate, such that the only things that we know to be so are merely what our culture has taught us, and we have no reason to be justified in our knowledge of those things outside of that. That approach would be actually more of a postmodern approach, which says that it's our linguistic communities that instruct us in the nature of reality, and we have no way of testing outside of that. I actually think we can get outside of that in a whole range of different things, including morality. But let me give an example of what I mean by intuitions. When and I might have even said this in the talk, but I just want to bring it back because others may not be aware of this. When I say something like all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, what follows from that?
And Socrates is mortal.
Yes, he's mortal. So, you know, this is straightforward and everybody gets the right answer. But I asked them, how is it that you knew that that was the right answer to those two pieces of information I gave you, the thing that followed from the two pieces of information? And people say, well, you can just see it. You know, you just it just seems clear or obvious. It presents itself. There's a way in which you see the relationship even though you're not seeing it with your eyes. If I said that Bill was taller than Mary and Mary was taller than Fred, we'd know that Bill was what regarding Fred?
Taller
than. So there's a relationship there that our mind grasps. And even if there's no Fred or Mary or whatever, we still would be able to understand that relationship and how one follows from the other. Now, I'm just using these things as examples of a certain type of intuition that's built in. Those are rational intuitions. The way the intuition works is that these are faculties that we possess that allow us to see something that is actually there, even though we've not been taught the particulars. And so I think I'm giving examples of rational intuitions because it will give you a feeling for how moral intuitions work as well, that there is a seeing of the moral quality. There is a perception that is a faculty that human beings seem to have as in their mind. And I think the faculty is operating because it seems to be a universal impulse for people to identify moral realities. They see these things and they describe them with their language. So language is not the creator of the moral reality. It is the descriptor of something that the person themselves sees. And the best example I can give of this is the universal complaint about the existence of evil in the world. When people say there is evil in the world, they are beholding something, and they are not just beholding an action like a rape or a murder, but they are killing. But they are beholding the moral quality of the thing and objecting to it. Just like you would be able to see how sums or mathematics principles are being violated or rational notions are being violated, you can see with a similar kind of faculty how moral notions are being violated. So that's what I mean by intuition. Go ahead.
Yes, I understand that, but it doesn't seem like it's universal in how people apply it, because the traditional, example of the Nazis, they didn't care that the Jews were dying, that they were committing genocide.
Right.
So it didn't apply to them that it was their moral intuition didn't tell them that the Jews were deserving of dignity and human life. So it still seems subjective to me.
Well, if what you mean by subjective is that there can be individual elements that can cloud the issue, then I agree with that. But it is not subjective by nature. It is objective by nature, but we may, for some subjective reason, may not always be able to apprehend it. First of all, by the way, I don't think that the Nazis or whatever just entirely saw that as so. I think some people understand that a thing is bad and they don't care because they are doing what they want. Okay, so it isn't like they just don't get it. Secondly, there are other things that have objective reality, like mathematics, and people get their sums wrong all the time. We wouldn't look at somebody who doesn't agree with certain math notions and say, well, this is evidence then that math isn't objective in some sense. We just think that some people are poor at math. And I think that can be true with one's conscience, and the conscience is a faculty that allows us to kind of perceive morality. The conscience certainly can be singed. And you can take people who ought to know better about something and socialize them to be entirely comfortable with immoral things, just like you can socialize people to be affirming completely irrational ideas. It doesn't mean that rationality is not operating or isn't real. It just means that they're not using it well at that time.
Okay. So the basic argument is that all people know what's right by nature. And they just, over time, do the act of their own free will.
Well, I would say that all properly functioning people have moral intuitions that are part of their makeup, just like they have rational intuitions or mathematical intuitions. But that doesn't mean that the faculties don't grow and develop in their ability to be expressed accurately. Just like, you know, we get better at our math, you know. It's the intuitions serve to justify the notions, but sometimes there is a clouding there. So, yeah, I think that part of what it means to be made in the image of God is to have these capabilities. But it doesn't mean that there can't be any outside influences that can't confound or confuse or distort those capabilities. And again, going back to math, I think a good parallel. There are differences that people have about what is right and wrong, but that doesn't cause me to doubt whether there is a right and wrong about most matters. I think it's easier to show that there is objective morality in general, and that's what I was doing in the talk at the Veritas Forum at UCLA, which, by the way, for listeners, is available on YouTube. So if you just you kind of Google my name on YouTube or YouTube my name or whatever they call it there and then put Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, or relativism, you'll probably find that entire lecture. But I'm just trying to make the case that there are some objective moral principles. I'm not trying in that talk to tell you what they all are. I think, you know, categorizing, getting the full taxonomy of moral goods is a lot harder. Some things seem to be really obvious. Other things depend on the circumstances to know which moral principle is the most applicable to that circumstance. So there's going to be subjective elements that enter in, and there are going to be judgment calls. I admit that.
Oh, okay.
All righty?
All right. All right, thank you.
I appreciate your call, Terrence. And for those of you who want to check that that out, just go to YouTube and type it in, and you'll have it. But I look younger there than I do now, as it's been a while. All right, more coming up. It's Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Final segment here at Stand to Reason, friends. I'm Greg Kokel, your host. And let me just quickly go to the callers. We'll see if we can get through them all. In Houston, I presume that would be Texas, Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Greg. How's it going?
Good. I'm doing fine. Thanks. What's up?
Yeah, I just I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the FIC church movement, Family Integrated Congregations, and get some of your thoughts on that.
Okay, the name is new to me, so yeah. You'll have to tell me a little bit about them.
Okay, basically it's called Family Integrated Churches. Mm-hmm. They're not really new. They've been around for, I don't know, probably 20, 30 years.
But oh, okay.
There's not a lot of them. You mind if I kind of paint a picture for you?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, because they may be around, but I'm just not. I don't think I'm familiar with them, so I'll need some substance here.
Sure. Well, basically, one of the things their whole structure, it's basically a paradigm shift that they're encouraging, in ecclesiological setup. They don't have youth ministries, mm-hmm. Children's ministries. But let me kind of paint a picture for the things they actually can work to address mm-hmm. better than the way things are going now.
Okay.
Just a couple of statistics here. 70-88% of kids are leaving the church by the end of their freshman year in college. Mm-hmm. Glenn Schultz's work, Kingdom Education, for the 70%, you can check that. Mm-hmm. 88%, you can check Southern Baptist Council on the Family Life, 2002 study mm-hmm. they did for the 88% there.
Okay, so there's this mass exodus. I think that's pretty clear.
Right, yes. Yeah. So we've got this going on. And then also, we have this sort of a movement away from the centrality of the home and the importance of the family in the world, or especially in America, you know, the current birth rate, replacement rate, is at 2.1 in the world. In America, we're at relatively 1.9. France is at 1.5. Germany, I think, is at 1.1. So just to kind of make that up a little bit, you know, kind of show a little bit more.
So we're we're going backwards. You have to have, I think, 2.2 in order to sustain something like that. But so, yeah, that's a bad picture. So I didn't realize it was so bad in this country, but go ahead.
Yeah. So we have that, just to kind of put more, you know, icing on that there. In France, Muslims are reproducing at a rate of 6 per family.
Right.
So within 2 generations, France will be
a Muslim country. It's over
with,
right. The numbers are pretty clear there. The rest of Europe, too. But how does that relate to this particular issue in the States with the FIC?
Yeah, so anyways, the FIC, they focus on families and, you know, just the high regard for families. Because basically, as the families go, so goes the church. To continue painting that picture, I guess. If let's take that lower 70%. Let's say it's 75%. And right now in America, Christian families are really not any better than the average family in America in terms of how many kids they're having. So currently, at 2 kids per family, at a 75% attrition rate, it currently takes 2 families with 2 kids each just to get 1 kid into the next generation of Christianity.
Okay.
And so the family integrated church model is saying there is a problem. And they're saying, I think they offer the best solution for the problem in the complete paradigm that they're talking about.
Okay, so this is a real problem, but I guess I have 2 questions about how they operate to fulfill this. One has to do with if there's any kind of doctrinal what's the word I'm looking for? Anything odd doctrinally? That's what I'm looking for, basically. Because a lot of times when you have, this sounds like it might be a home church kind of movement, when you have these, and I don't know if this is decentralized or not, but it sounds like it might be somewhat decentralized. So you have a lot of local autonomy, and you have smaller groups. Then it just seems to be a breeding ground for weirdness. So that would be my first question. And then the second thing is what if that. That aside, if that's not a problem, then what are the other things? I have, in my model, a lot of flexibility culturally for how the church can express itself. And if this is a local church that's working hard to strengthen the family because they don't send their kids to youth groups or things like that. I mean, I have very mixed feelings about these so-called age-appropriate services. As one person put it, the only time the family's together on Sunday is when they're driving to church and when they're going away from it, but they all go to separate churches once they get to the church, you know, and I think that that's a problem. So what do you have to say about those 2 particulars?
Yeah, that's one thing. They call that age segregation in the church, and so they don't do that. You know, one thing they focus on is and having children. You know, Psalms says, children are a heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Each man should fill his quiver full of them, and he will not be ashamed of when he meets
Right, right. Okay, yeah, I got that. So,
So
as far as their doctrine, I mean, are they like creedal Christians? Are they, you know, this isn't this heavy authoritarian trip, you know, authority trip, you know, that you get sometimes in these smaller groups? No red flags for you there?
Some, you know, you have different doctrinal positions. Some of them are Southern Baptists. But they just don't set their ecclesiology up a certain way. You know, basically they're saying, we see the problem, what's happening in America. In the last 30 years, we've had more parachurch organizations dedicated to youth, more youth ministry degrees handed out, more youth ministry positions than ever in the history of the church. And yet only now do we have the lowest baptism rate.
Okay, so I guess you're continuing, Paul, to identify the problem, which I agree with, but I think you wanted me to respond to the FIC in particular, so I was just asking for more details. I mean, I am totally in favor in principle of things, anything that will strengthen the family structure in the church, and if there are local churches that are doing more on a local level and a communitarian level to strengthen that relationship and to train more Christians and to cut down on the attrition rate of young people going to college, I'm all for that. My only red flag would be if there's some doctrinal weirdness, but you haven't mentioned that, so I guess I don't have any concerns.
I'm sure there might be some, because you do find, you know, some of them might be Mennonite churches, some are Baptist, some are non-denominational. So I guess that's more of an individual basis kind of thing.
Okay.
Some are Southern Baptists.
But nothing, no, you haven't seen anything inherent to that movement that bothers you?
Not in the ones that I've attended, okay. The books I've read by some of the pastors, like Family-Driven Faith.
Yeah. Okay.
Excellent book on talks about that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to move on to another caller here. But Paul, thank you for telling me about the details here and at least introducing me to this concept. And maybe we'll have more conversation about it later. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Anaheim. This would be Trudy. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Trudy.
Oh, thank you so much for allowing me to speak to you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your ministry, and thanks. I just have to tell you, I love your Facebook. I just love your little posts and the little comments that we all make. It just makes me feel part of your family.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that. Since there's 2,200 members of that particular family at one point, I'm glad you still feel warm and enfolded there.
It's wonderful.
That's
I
great.
Love the pictures when you went back for the reunion and the birthday party. It was just, I just love it.
Well, great. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
All right. My question today is regarding James. In the first chapter, down in verse 14 and 15, each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. When lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death.
Right.
What death is it that he's talking about?
Well, I was giving this some thought during the break because I saw the question coming up, and I went to James 1, and I'm familiar with this passage. And I thought, well, it couldn't be spiritual death because spiritual death is already a reality, all right, for non, you know, we start out that way. So it isn't
right.
Like these doing bad things create spiritual death. And it's not talking about physical death because physical death is an eventuality, but it doesn't happen every time we fulfill these requirements. So if it's neither of those two things, then I'm thinking, well, what kind of death could be in view here? Because it certainly doesn't mean that if you're spiritually alive, then you spiritually die, because everybody would be spiritually dead after they're spiritually alive, because everybody falls into this pattern at one time or another. You know, I don't believe in Christian perfectionism.
Right.
So I take this then to mean, when it speaks of death here, to mean something in a more general sense, that it works out the destruction that is the inevitability of letting sin reign. So it is a destruction or a corruption in the given circumstance. So if you, let's just say, he uses the word lust here, it doesn't always mean a sensual, sexual thing.
No,
but
I was going to say, I knew that was...
It doesn't always mean, but that would certainly categorize that. So I'm just,
I
use that as an example, so a man is tempted by, carried away in this case, the illustration I'm giving is by a physical lust, sexual lust, sensual lust, and there's this temptation, and he pauses and he dwells upon it, and as he dwells upon it, it gives birth to sin. Okay, that is, then he is trading on this desire to fulfill the lust that he's feeling, and then what does he do? Then he goes out and he accomplishes the sin that he is lusting about. So it's not just a sin of thought now, it's a sin in action. And something is corrupted as a result of it. And even if he doesn't, in a sense, act out the lustful desires that he's trading on, there's something in him that is dying as he is in the circumstance of letting sin reign in that area of his mind. Something is being destroyed. Something is dying in a broad sense.
Okay, so you're saying that death could maybe be seen as corrupted then?
Corruption or destruction. In other words, sin destroys is a way of thinking about it. That there's something that is lost and destroyed and damaged and corrupted whenever we give in to sin. And whenever we live in a holy life, there's something that is restored and built up, and life is given when we do that, by contrast.
Okay. So if I'm talking to someone who says, this obviously is a verse that shows that we can lose our salvation because we can end in death. I don't have the Greek to be able to say, well, no, because it just means corrupted.
Well, the Greek...
That makes sense to me. I completely understand that, and it makes sense to me. How do I present the argument then in such a way that I can go, no, what you're saying really isn't valid. If you
well, there's
further.
Two. Okay, that's good. I'm rushing because we're short now, but I on time. But there are two ways to do it. One is to make an argument from other passages that you know that you have security in Christ, and therefore that we should seek a different way of understanding this passage. But even if I take this passage in isolation, I wouldn't go there, because if that were the way, if this is what James were talking about here, then every single one of us would be irreparably lost after we are saved. Once
We
enter into spiritual life, then what happens? Then we are tempted when we're carried away and enticed by our own lust. Okay, does that happen to us? Yes, but that's not yet sin. But when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. It seems that there's a dwelling on it or a toying with this personally, this lustful temptation. We give into the temptation, it gives birth to sin, which when accomplished kills something. Okay.
If it killed
our spiritual life in us, well, for goodness sake, first of all, every one of us would be dead.
Yeah.
Because every one of us goes through this thing probably every single day.
Well, exactly. Well, and I had Sunday school teacher say, well, it's not eternal death, it's not physical death, so it means spiritual death. And I went, yeah, wait a minute.
Spiritual death is eternal death.
Well, okay. Well, he was thinking of a commentary that he read where somebody said there were three types of death. And I kind of went, oh, wait a minute. But let me ask you real
quick. Okay, wait. Spiritual, eternal death is spiritual death forever.
I agree.
Okay.
I agree with that. But I didn't, that was a side discussion. Now, does this correlate with the faith, without faith? Oh, gee, many Christmas. Without works, our faith is dead. Is that the same kind of thing?
No, that comes in the next chapter. I think it's talking about something different. And incidentally, the Greek is not going to help you here, probably. Because it isn't like every nuance of definition is captured. I mean, like, words aren't univocal, usually. They have one meaning. They have many meanings. It depends on what you're talking about.
Oh, in the context.
So look at the English word death. We could be using that, man, I died in that moment. I tell you, man, I was so embarrassed I died. Well, it's the context that tells you the meaning.
Okay.
Okay.
That just was a light bulb for me.
Yeah.
So but the thing is, when I run into these people all the time, and I'm going, okay, I need something to be, and you know what? Just like we have our verses that talk about eternal life, but then eternal life is only eternal as long as you're in the right relationship with Jesus.
Yeah, well, then it's not eternal. I mean, that's
and
playing with
crazy.
Games.
It
yeah,
really
that is crazy making, but I got to go. But listen, just ask them, has this ever happened to you? Did this happen to any of them in this week? If it did, then they're lost. See, I mean, if that's what this means, then we're all sunk. And I don't know what confidence we can have. We're certainly not rescued by Jesus if we can lose ourselves so quickly. Thanks for the call, Trudy. Great talking with you. And that's the end of our time together. If you go to our website, your homework at str.org is our article of the featured article, which is Unstringing the Violinist. Scott Klusner was here with me talking about abortion. This deals with one of the most powerful arguments in favor of choice that I hope. And I think you'll find I deal with. I think I do. Anyway, check that out. Unstringing the Violinist. I'll be back next week. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven, my friends. I'm Greg Kochel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.